Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to this July workshop for the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm going to ask if everyone can please stand to recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all very much. First, I want to thank Mr. Coolman for being here today. We have three vacancies on the board, and they will be hopefully named by the end of this week. We also know that Mr. Sterling will not be here as well as Mr. Miller. So what pretty much you see is what you get. And with that, I'm going to leave. And you're moving down. I'm looking at
you. We have a senior member with us. Mr. Mark.
We're going to kick off the workshop, and I'm going to ask Mr. Branson, please come on up.
Let's take on your side. We got more over here.
Mr. Secretary, is this allowed? I mean, you have to watch these asphalt guys. You know? They're paving their way for something.
we're trying to pave all angles, sir. Yes, sir.
The cement guys gave us much nicer.
They need to. Mr. Chairman, we appreciate the opportunity to be here. We've spoke before the board, you know, previously, and there's been We've come and talked before when there was some concern about delivering the program that you guys have put forth. But we just get this opportunity now to introduce our industry a little bit and what we do and who we are. Our membership covers, you know, from Lee County to the Eastern Shore, Emporia, Danville, Leesburg, Northern Virginia, Winchester to Virginia Beach. So, we're in all areas of the state. Our industry is grown here in Virginia. We have the opportunity, our employees all live here in Virginia. And just to give you a chance to introduce a little bit about, again, what we do to help implement the program that you guys put together and the projects that you vote on. So our membership is based up, you know, we have a member that is president of the Asphalt Association, but the real brains behind the operation is our executive director, Richard Schreck, will be giving the technical presentation. Our industry is a technical one. We work closely with VDOT and their materials to implement specifications that go into our contract and provide the best quality pavements that we can afford to benefit the Commonwealth. So the Asphalt Association has been in existence 62 years. Richard has been our executive director for half that time, 31 years. We appreciate the job that he does for us, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Richard Schreck. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Why? The attachment?
Out of here.
All right, let's try it. Thank you. I'm going to be real brief, just kind of give you a quick overview of the industry, but it's one of those things where you kind of give an overview of the industry and let you tell you just a little bit about what it is we produce. So this is real quick and dirty. I'm going to pass around two things with you that I will end up talking to. Carrying those up in the parking lot way down the hill was not something I really want to do this morning, so please look at them. Asphalt, what is called bitumen, is a natural substance that exists out there. It has very unique engineering properties. It's sticky and elastic. It can also stretch and flex. It's not water soluble, so it makes a good waterproofing material. Many foundations, for example, are done with that. At air temperatures, it's a solid. So what you see around and go around a can is nothing more than pure liquid asphalt, the binder, if you will, that holds the mix together at room temperature. You put your thumbnail on it, it's a very hard substance, where the other sample is a combination of the aggregate and the coated particle. When heated, it comes thinner and acts as a lubricant, which is what you see out on the road we do paving. It exists naturally. Trinidad Lake Asphalt was one of the first places where they found it. There's also some Labria tar pits, they're called, in downtown Los Angeles, where it's been bubbling out of the ground for some 10,000 years. But most of the asphalt that we use today is a byproduct of the refining of petroleum. Okay, it's what's left over at the bottom when they're done. A little bit of asphalt use history. It's one of the most oldest engineering products. The Sumerian shipbuilding industry used it to waterproof their ships. And everybody pretty much knows the story of Moses being put in a basket, float down the Nile River. Asphalt was used to seal the reeds of the basket so that it was waterproof, and that Moses didn't sink in the Nile. But a little hard on the Jewish people if that had happened. But what you kind of refer to as asphalt is actually the sample going around here is a combination of the binder with aggregate. Sometimes we call it in the DOT asphalt concrete, sometimes the bituminous concrete, blacktop. In the industry, we just line call it asphalt. But it's a composition of the binder and aggregate. And it's an engineered product and very unique in that we can lay it in very thin layers and we can make many different things and we can lay it in very thick layers. Kind of a little bit of history on it. The first streets that we know of that were paved with asphalt were done by Ulysses Grant up in Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. using Trinidad Lake asphalt. It lasted 31 years and the petroleum industry had this residue at the end of their they didn't know what to do with it. At the end, said, well, hey, that's the same stuff that you paved with. So they talked him in when they resurfaced it to use the petroleum residue as the material, the binding material, and we've been doing that ever since. As I said, it's an engineered product. There are more tests and more gradations and evaluations to make asphalt work than about any other product because it has so much flexibility in the things you can do with it. It is also 100% recyclable. Now, recycling is a big thing for a lot of people these days, so they really don't truly understand, and we could almost say that asphalt is renewable. If you will, you think of two-part epoxy, where you buy them in the grocery in the hardware store, you put them together, a chemical reaction takes place, and now you have a binding agent. Cement works that way. It mixes with water, there's a chemical reaction, it becomes then a binding agent to make concrete. Well, asphalt is unique in that we don't chemically change anything. All we've done is heat it up to the point that it can coat the aggregate particles. So we get to, when we recycle asphalt, we're recycling both parts. We get the rock again, and we get the binder again, and there's no limit to how many times we can reuse that stuff. So it has become the world's most recycled product. And 80% of the asphalt that is taken up every year when they're renewing surface and stuff goes back into new asphalt on the roadways. The other 20% we're still working on trying not to get that out of the system. A few pavement facts. Some are national, some are Virginia. 94% of the nation's highways are paved with asphalt as a surface. 89%, I used 1980 just as an example, but looking through VDOT data, but in 1980, 89% of Virginia's primary roads were paved with asphalt on the surface. They may or may not originally been asphalt, but they had been overlaid. 2011, 97% of your primary roads are paved with asphalt. In the interstate system, 1980, 71% of all your interstates in Virginia were asphalt. Today, 32 years later, about 85% are paved as we have begun to rehab older white pavement. And 90%, here's a telling thing in the industry, 90% of what we produced last year, though, is surface mix. And what that tells you is, as an industry, we're just doing maintenance. We're not building anything new. I think you guys already know that. Fuel effect. Zero, that's the number of concrete paving companies that are domiciled in the state of Virginia. In 2011, you spent $379 million in asphalt maintenance contracts. That's an average of $6,000, almost $7,000 a lane mile for the number of lane miles that you have in the system that are asphalt. You spent $60 million in 2011 patching concrete pavement. For an average, you got just 1,100 lane miles of concrete pavement on your primary interstate system. That's for $27,000 per lane mile. So we think, you know, asphalt as a maintenance item is a pretty good deal for you. As an industry, there are 31 asphalt producer companies that are in Virginia. And they own 122 asphalt plants around the state. Last year, they produced some 10 million tons of asphalt. And that's down significantly from past years. We're at about 35% capacity, if you will, in what they're capable of producing. It's a $537 million investment in Virginia. $200 million of that is in the value of plants. Many of these plants are old, and if you buy a new plant, David can tell you, it's about a $5 million investment to put up a new plant. So we, at a 35% capacity, we're not putting up a whole lot of new plants. There's $337 million worth of capital investment in the rest of the rollers, the pavers, the laboratory equipment, and all the rest of it. We employ some 6,500 Virginians to work in the industry with almost $240 million worth of annual wages. There are roughly 2,000 independent truckers and contract truckers across the state that haul the asphalt from the, you know, the materials to the asphalt plants, and that is a place where we use a number of minority companies because it's easy for them to entry level in the construction industry to be a contract hauler, and some $150 million is spent every year to haul those materials. We purchase somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million in materials. That's stone. That's liquid asphalt. That's diesel fuel for running the plants and all the other natural gas and everything else that we are using. Our revenues as an industry last year were a little over $1 billion, so that's what they're paying taxes on in the Commonwealth. VDOT is our number one customer. 58% of our work last year was on VDOT. Historically, that's high because what's missing is not that VDOT's doing a lot of work, but we, like everyone else, has been impacted significantly by the absence of a private market. So 80% of the tonnage the VDOT tonnage last year was maintenance, and historically that was a 50-50 between new construction versus maintenance work. Our other customers, if you will, as an industry, is 28% is in the commercial of the private side, and that, again, is the part of the market that has been the most significantly impacted as the housing and new development market disappeared a number of years ago. Approximately 8% goes to the municipalities for their systems, streets and subdivisions, and there's some 6% on average that are what we call direct federal, where there are the parks, the Blue Ridge Parkway, and those types of things that the federal government handles directly. Again, that's as fast and quick as dirty as we can tell you what the industry is and who we are and what the product is, but I'll be glad to answer any questions you have.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to say thank you for coming, and I had the great pleasure of visiting Ed's place, Chemung Asphalt Plant in Culpeper, where they actually make it, and they have a quarry where they blast the stone and then mix it. It was an amazing experience. And
let me guess, Ed did a shot for you too, didn't he?
He did. I had a blast.
Everybody loves a good explosion.
Yeah,
so Ed always blows up something when he's there, yeah. And usually it's the rock in the quarry.
It was good.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Could you tell me what has been the increase in cost in the past few years in asphalt, since it is a byproduct of petroleum, and since the current federal administration is not interested in exploring any here in this country, increasing reserves of oil? What have they done to the price of asphalt?
Well, we speak in phrases within the industry, but historically it was a byproduct, and like everything else, it's a byproduct. Once the oil companies come up with a way of using it and making it not a byproduct, all of a sudden the price goes up. And I don't know if you've ever heard of a coker, but a coking process is a different way of refining what enables them to get in and crack that bottom material. So if they coke the material and their coker's going online, that takes the asphalt and makes something else out of it. So what's happened to us is we have to be competitive from the oil company standpoint with gasoline and diesel fuel and stuff. So we kind of ride the same way that you ride at the pump, because they are going to get the same margin out of asphalt as they get out of the other fuels. It's a complicated issue in this, but the world demand for oil, be it in form of gasoline or fuels or in asphalt, is going up. As China and India and those kind of markets, think of the development that's going on there, and so the demand for it is, and that's what's driving it. So everyone needs to be seeking alternatives to some of the stuff, but also we need to be going out there and getting every bit that we can get our hands on.
But how much has the price increased? That's the question I'm asking. The past few years, I'd say.
I'd say in the last, we've come back down. We had a spike there in 2008 and 2009 that went from $400 a liquid ton to almost $1,000, and now it's back down in the 600 range, little, you know, 650 range.
Thank you. Cool, man.
Thank you very much. One of the big marches of progress is in material science now. As an engineered product, you potentially have the possibility of taking advantage of some of those breakthroughs. But is this product sufficiently, let's call it, sophisticated that it can take advantage of different types of aggregate materials, different binders, different things that people are looking at now, even at the molecular and lower levels? Or is this kind of a place in time that you've got the formula right and this is sort of the way asphalt's going to look for the next few decades?
I would tell you that we've not scratched the surface of what the capabilities of asphalt are. Our biggest drawback is in the world today, asphalt is a material science. Okay? And across this country, material science in universities is not new age. Everybody wants to do things on a computer. I mean, you all got one sitting in front of you. That's what you want to do, and that's what you'll learn. Asphalt's going to get dirty. It's black, it's sticky. It means you got to be in a soils lab, an asphalt lab, and materials lab, and play with materials. And more universities are getting rid of completely their materials lab. There's no soil work, there's no asphalt work, there's no concrete work done, and it's all computer modeling. And in our industry, you got to get dirty.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up question, if I could. We hear a little bit about quiet pavement. Is that simply a change in the mix of the materials that you use, or is there some additional material that goes in to make a quieter pavement?
No, it is still rock and asphalt, but it is changing what that combination looks like. So in the case of it's a rock, it's an open graded material, and it's laid very thin, and it's the open texture of it that captures the noise, the sound waves within that open structure. And we lay it typically 1 inch or less as a final surface.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Europe, where it's a lot of quiet technology that's forced in Europe, it doesn't matter if the pavement's black or white, they still make them put the asphalt on top to be the quiet to reach the sound of noise. There are issues with doing that. Okay, so and you typically see use of quiet technology in non-snow states, because you start putting sanding and icing stuff on an open texture, you clog up the open texture, then you're clogging up what was giving you the reduction in sound. So that's why we're looking at this with the department. And with Delegate May, some research projects to look at whether or not we can use that technology to mitigate noise in Virginia. School's out.
Mr. Colvin, Mr. Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Schreck, for being here. Very informational. Of the 31 producers in the Commonwealth, how many do you think are hedging within the petroleum commodities market for products?
None.
And why is that?
I would say it's a little bit different, but none of our, with very few exceptions, our industry in this state are just contractors. And the exception being, as mentioned, Chemung, Ed Dalrymple actually owns a quarry and also is in the asphalt business. But we have none who also, you know, buy, a wholesale buy and have tanks where they store binder heading for the future. So, and in the system we have here, the oil companies, where they price them, you're going to buy current market price. They're not going to give you a price that's good for 6 months or good for a year or good for 2 months. You're going to buy in the open market, and that's why the department has an index to kind of track that.
And is there a role in your mind for the Commonwealth to take advantage of that through hedging?
No, because price is so complicated and how it gets kind of right. It's like trying to say, can you get in the gasoline or diesel fuel market and hedge that? I haven't figured out how to do it. There's better people than me.
Well, a manufacturer can produce it if they have a hedge to play it off against. The hedge would be the common for the, whoever the customer is, if the customer is interested in a fixed price.
There's just too many other external factors. And then once you've got it, when it price goes up, it's like, to me, it's like canned goods in the grocery store. You know, when the price goes up, they go through and relabel everything. So if you for a higher price, well, they've already bought that, it's already on the shelves and stuff. I just don't see it working that way.
Thanks, Mr. Rich.
And Mr. I wanted to comment briefly on the research. I had the privilege of going through Dr. Gomez's facility in Charlottesville, our own BDOT Research Center, and they are doing amazing research on asphalt and other road surfaces. And one of these days, maybe we should go there, Mr. Chairman, and see that. But he really is running a first-rate operation there in Charlottesville, our own research center. So we're doing it, a lot of it ourselves. Do you all have any interaction with...
Oh, very much so. I'm on the Research Advisory Committee. I work very closely with all of them. We're working with the department on to build some test sites out at the National Center for Asphalt Technology test track at Auburn University. There are two quiet sections, and we're looking at three cold recycling, where we literally save the energy of not having to run the asphalt, heat it, and run it to an asphalt plant, which takes gas, natural gas or number six or number two heating oil to heat up that liquid you saw going around. So we're very closely with them.
Great. Thanks. Mr. Fowler?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Schreck, for coming in this morning. Maybe you could talk to us about how doing an asphalt overlay over existing concrete pavement, that being Portland cement concrete pavement, how does that affect the life cycle, or how does that improve the life cycle of the overall road section as opposed to just replacing the Portland cement concrete pavement by itself?
We were trying to stay away from any competitive, because we recognize that's our competitive industry.
But life cycle.
From our standpoint, when we've encouraged the department to separate the maintenance of black on black from black on white. Because if you look at it, the asphalt and concrete have different coefficients of expansion. So if you look at concrete pavements or driveway or whatever, you have to put joints in there because the stresses allow them to move and contract. Then when you go to lay asphalt on top of it, if it's a jointed concrete pavement, if you watch, where does the pavement fail first? It is the joint, because they continue to move because that's a function of the concrete, and it eventually tears the asphalt over the top of the joint. So then the department or any agency ends up having to do maintenance on those pavements because of joint failure, which is not the asphalt. So, there are things you can do to mitigate that, but I mean, you could weld plate steel across that joint, and you can't stop the concrete from moving. Some of the type of concrete that have gone, 295, for example, is continuous reinforced, which works very well because the cracks in the concrete are real close together and they don't move very much. So we've done an excellent job in being able to put relatively thin 3 to 5 inch layers on top of that as a new riding surface for the public. Downtown Expressway, if you will, that was something I worked with them, it's been over 10 years ago now, to rehab that concrete pavement there. So it's easily done, and it's why you see in the statistics over the years the department has as the time came, you rehab your old concrete or all old pavements by doing an overlay. And the reality of it, with the amount of traffic on most roadways today, is very rarely can we take up a pavement and put it back. What are you going to do with the traffic that's just on it while you do that? So we have to do a system where we live with the maintenance by covering up what's there and try to come up with ways in which to make it last longer.
Right. And in theory, it should really last forever because you can always strip the old asphalt off, recycle it, and repave it.
Well, and it's one thing that separates it. Think of your house and a roof. You put shingles on your roof. If you've got asphalt shingles, which, by the way, we recycle asphalt shingles into asphalt pavements now because we can use that binder, the same binder. But your shingles, you know, you might have 15-year shingles if you went cheap, or you might have 30-year shingles. At some point, though, you're going to have to replace it. If you don't, then the element gets to your roof and your foundation, and you got greater problem. Well, asphalt surface is a waterproof, a sacrificial layer, and it is intended to be the roof over the pavement structure, be it a white structure or an asphalt structure. So as long as you maintain that, and that means every 10 to 20 years, depending on which asphalt you chose to put on there, and how if you put enough on there, then you just renew that surface, and the pavement lasts indefinitely. Where you see it's going deeper than that is where you didn't do your maintenance in a timely manner, or there are other issues that came into play. So we just renew our surface. And, you know, 81 is a perfect example. 81 was built, frankly, because nobody thought there'd be any trucks on 81. Kind of missed that one, didn't they? So it's only 9 inches or 11 inches of pavement. Some areas only 9 inches of pavement. But it's still there, and we just renew the upper layer. 80% of the original pavement is still there. The one with the coal recycling job, the failure that up in the Stanton area, that failure was underneath the pavement. Hey, when that happens, to fix it, you got to get the pavement up, whatever pavement is, and fix what's underneath. And that's where they're doing the coal technology, and we're thinking maybe that's a future for it.
Mr. Mark?
Actually, that last question covered so much of what I was interested in. I just asked.
Another question? Mr. Shrek, Mr. Grantham, appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate very much the rulers, too. Excellent. We will now turn to Mr. Lawson and the financial report.
Good morning, everyone. Good
morning.
Good
morning. You got good news or bad news?
Always good news.
Okay, when you answer like that, you know we're in trouble. Go ahead.
Is that budget cutting going on outside?
This morning, what I'm going to be giving you this is kind of an overview of our preliminary close data for fiscal year 2012. So we won't actually close out 2012 until closer to the end of the month. As you know, the governor and the secretary don't release final revenue numbers until they make their presentation to the joint committee in the middle of August. But what I thought I would do today is just give you some indications of what we've seen in terms of our own collection data. As I've been reporting all year, the motor fuel tax has been kind of trailing forecast. They reduced the forecast down to a reduction of 1.4% in December. Based on actual collections, I think last month I informed you that we were up to about 1% reduction versus a 1.4% reduction in the forecast. It looks like now from our data that we'll actually exceed that and may actually post a slight increase year over year from 2011. Looks like June is always a strong month in the way that the collections come in. In terms of motor vehicle sales, as you've seen all year, we've continued to post growth significantly greater than forecast. Forecasted growth of 4%, and we think we'll end the year at about a 9% growth. and the sales and use tax, retail sales and use tax, does appear that it should meet forecasted growth. In terms of federal revenue, we collected about $32 million more than we did in fiscal year 2011. And as you can see here, the majority of that, or the main driver for that, was a 17% growth in the maintenance, the revenue associated with the maintenance program. Spending from a big picture, big year for 2012. Our total spending exceeded $4 billion. $500 million greater than it was last year. That's about a 14% increase in total spending. 43% of the spending was related to VDOT's maintenance program. And if you include maintenance payments or the financial assistance to localities, that brings the maintenance component of our spending to about 52%. Construction spending, which does include our R project activity, is 34% of total spending. In terms of our contracts, we've got $2.7 billion in contracts on the street. It's about $300 million above where we were this time last year. And of those contracts, the maintenance and construction contracts have $1.3 billion of unspent balance. So about nearly half of the contract balances are to be expended. This is the graphic that just shows you the year-over-year comparison of spending between the programs. You can see that with the exception of maintenance and construction, the two are very similar. As I previously mentioned, we had some significant growth in both maintenance and construction. Maintenance program. We had a big month in June. Spent $200 million. Brought our total spending to date to just shy of $1.8 billion. That's a 26% increase in spending over fiscal year 2011. We had anticipated spending $1.79 billion versus the $1.77. So you can see we came very close to what we expected. In fact, based on preliminary data, the spending, actual spending, is within about $23 million of what the forecast was. And based on this data, it looks like the unspent allocation balance will be $177 million. And as you see, that is a tremendous reduction from the $485 million balance that we had in 2011. The construction program. Again, saw an increase of almost 12% over fiscal year 2011, spending $1.4 billion, and that was within $1 million of what the air adjusted forecast was for the program. This anticipated spending chart, again, now that we're at the end of the year, all you need to look at is the last three columns. You can see here the variances between the spending by program and what was forecasted. Across all programs, we spent about $73 million less than we had anticipated. And you can see some of those are kind of good news. We spent a little less than admin. I've already talked about the changes in maintenance and construction. From a cash position, bottom line, we are actually up $100 million from this time last year. But the important information is more into details. You can see a significant reduction in the first line, the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, as we brought that balance down, contributed based on the additional spending and maintenance. And you see the tremendous reduction in the construction cash balance as we capitalize the infrastructure bank as well as incur additional expenditures in those programs. The increase you see there is based on the proceeds obtained from the bond sales.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So often, who maintains the investment of the bond proceeds until they're spent?
They're held by the trustee. They're held by SNAP.
And are they interest-bearing and all that?
Yes, they do. Of course, they have. You have the arbitrage, obviously, issues that they are interest-bearing, and they retain their own interest.
Okay. Thank you.
Just to kind of wrap up, as you saw, the spending for the year for most of the programs were pretty close to what we had forecasted. Maintenance spending hit an all-time high in 2012. In fact, if you were to look back in time, the $1.8 billion we spent in 2012 was about double what we had spent if you go back 6 or 8 years. So it was a very, very big year in terms of maintenance activity. Based on this data, we are looking at an unspent maintenance allocation balance of $177 million. That's a 64% reduction of the balance of $485 that we had in 2011. And as I mentioned, in terms of cash, this accelerated spending that has taken place in 2012 has also helped us address cash. I think you saw before we had some very large cash balances at the end of last year, and the cash balances we're now showing in the maintenance fund and in the construction fund are within that 60-day range that we've said to be a good place to operate.
Mr.
Yes,
yes, Mr. Watson, on that one point on the turn of the money, what is your goal there? Is 60 days within your goal range, or would you like to see that down to 30, or what's safe but yet a goal?
The 60-day range, in fact, if you go back to the CBH audit, that as well as previous information we had gotten from JLARC and the Auditor of Public Accounts, have all said something in that 60-day range is a good operating buffer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Mr. Ross, a couple questions. One is, we often talk about how much more we spent, and that's a good thing, but do we have a list of what we were able to accomplish with that extra money spent, percentage-wise, of what we normally have spent? I mean, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, but just because we spent more money, did we get a good return out of it, and what kind of projects were completed as a result of it?
Yeah, and I don't have those details, but I'm sure Ms. Sorrell at another time could provide you with some statistics in terms of how many miles of pavement that were done and other types of maintenance activities that were done with the increased funding. From a construction standpoint, we can easily pull out and identify projects to identify some of those highlights that are taking place.
I think that would be good because I think, first of all, the public sometimes has a cynical view of what we accomplish and what we don't accomplish. And I think when we say we're spending more money, they sometimes look at that with a jaded eye because of the fact that we're not sure that we're spending it well. So if we could identify what we've accomplished with that additional outlay, I think it would be beneficial for the public information. Second of all, I think we've had a lot of discussion on the tolling issue, and a lot of it written in the paper. I've been reading about that. And I have a question because I looked at the budget figures that were sent, the long version, that was sent through the computer. And on page 45, it identified in 2010, intake from tolling, income from tolling was $16.3 million. The outflow for expenditures was $22.9 million. In 2011, the income was identified as $16 million, spending was $13 million. Those 2 years alone, we were about $3 million behind in as far as expenditures to revenue. But yet when I look at the figures that you just handed out today on actual 2011, we're showing income or revenues of $27 million as opposed to $16 million, and expenditures of $17 million as opposed to $13 million. Can you enlighten me as to why these figures are different? I mean, are they other things added in? I mean, it looks to me like total revenues would be what people pay. That would be the revenue, and there'd be nothing else mixed in with it. Maybe you should agree. I don't know if I'm missing something here, and that's where I'd like to be.
I'd have to go back and look at the actual numbers, but if we look at the toll program, what we call Program 606, it includes the toll facility revolving fund, and it in addition to the toll revenue that's actually collected by the two toll facilities that we maintain, Coleman and Fulbright, toll facility revolving fund is housed in there, and it receives interest income off the monies earned off of, on the HMO and the construction. So you'll see a significant, you could get $12-15 million worth of interest income in that fund in addition to just the pure toll revenue.
I guess what I'm getting at is the point that if we're going to put in tolling facilities, I would certainly hope that the revenue on its own, not federal funds, not other revolving funds, not other stuff, revenues alone coming through those gates would be from people traveling, and that would be an excess of what we are spending out to operate this. And if it's not, whether we've got a revolving fund or not, then the question begs itself of, do we want to continue doing something like that in a business model? You would not, because you're not getting money back from what you spent. Therefore, is there a better way to approach it? And one of the, of course, seems a lot simpler for people, and I know there's reluctance to do this, and when I was there, I had the same reluctance. Adding 10 cents for the gas tax, which you close for everybody, as opposed to doing something else that looks like it's not a tax. Mm-hmm. But when you're inconveniencing people to go out to a transponder, put money in their account, do all these types of things every month, then you would certainly hope that the return from that is greater than what we've had to spend out to accomplish it. And I'm just hoping that we can kind of monitor that closely. I think these are some of the decisions that have to be looked at and then passed on, and hopefully the General Assembly will look at it in that regard. Because we need to make things, if people are going to be contributing, so to speak, anyway, we need to make it as simple for them and as painless as possible. I think it needs to be more applied to what is actually happening as far as bringing in the money.
So the two facilities we have, Coleman, you know, it still has outstanding debt, bonds, and its revenues are supporting the operation of the facility and the debt service. It is a self-supporting facility in that respect. The Fullway Parkway Extension is the other facility that VDOT maintains. The bonds have been retired, and what we are continuing to incur or collect tolls for are for the, there's an outstanding loan to Chesterfield County, as well as there's monies due back to the revolving fund that are being repaid from those, because Fort White Parkway didn't, it was actually subsidized, you know, during its period of time.
So in that regard then, the ones that are bond-free, so to speak, are getting more revenue than they're spending out for maintenance and employees and anything else that might be associated with operating those facilities.
The facility, the maintenance of the roadway of the facility is included within the maintenance program. The toll facility revenues support the operation of the maintenance of the toll facility itself, the toll operation.
Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Cole, did you have an...
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lawson, your comment regarding the 60-day cash balance being an appropriate target, if we dig down into the detail, are you also saying that $177 million in unspent maintenance is also a target? And that's obviously, your 60 days is made up of a number of different components.
The unspent maintenance balance, allocation balance, is a little higher than what we were working for. I think we had said we'd like to bring it down under $100 million. And where we're looking at for the next fiscal year, we'll definitely be within under $100 million at the end of 13.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chief?
Yes. I'm following up on Alan's questions. I think in my earlier conversation, you were concerned about what we actually get out of the tolls. If the General Assembly were to raise the gas tax, do we have to hire any new employees? Is there any cost to VDOT or the Commonwealth if we simply raise the gas tax to collect those funds?
From a collection perspective,
yeah.
No, sir. There would not be any additional efforts required to.
So every penny that tax is raised is just pure revenue with no extra cost whatsoever.
Yes, the first. Mr. Lawson, can you tell us what's going on with the federal bill that just passed? How do you see that
affecting the highway bill?
Actually, I think that's the next presentation.
Well, is that the next? Okay.
At least very shortly thereafter.
I didn't see it on this thing.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
a follow-up to Mr. Dick's comment. There is a cost to that, but it's not necessarily borne by the government. There is a cost whenever you raise the price of a retail product, the transaction fees, which amount to about 80% of all purchases, credit card fees and whatnot, that goes up. And so there is a cost there. It's not a cost.
Thank you, Mr. Lane.
I have a follow-up question to the trustee. In today's world of financial surprises, looks like we got $1.2 billion almost sitting with the trustee. I assume it's two trustees got it broken out. But, I mean, we've vetted those guys. There's no, you know, is that our responsibility? Is that somebody else? Because you pick up the paper every day now and you read it with some other third-party risk. Is out there. We're comfortable with all that.
Yeah, we've worked through Treasury and that selecting the trustees.
So you're comfortable?
Oh, yes, sir. Very much so.
Actually, the treasurer handles all of our cash and the investment of all that. They have certain guidelines that we use to follow. So all of the cash that you see on those financial statements, the treasurer will select the banks and the trustee.
Any other questions? Lawson, thank you very much. The RPT.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to give a brief update on quarterly financial update for DRPT. As Mr. Lawson has pointed out, we're in the middle of year-end close. I believe these numbers are good. I've given you all the quarterly update report in addition to this presentation, but I just want to reiterate, as Mr. Lawson did, that these are preliminary numbers. So there's a possibility we missed something, and we're continuing to reconcile for the next week or so. So if I do find something, I will send out an updated set of information. With that being said, the report you have is similar to all the quarterly reports. You're basically showing all our resources that we have, receivables, cash on hand, anticipated revenues, and then we're matching that up against all of our commitments, all our grants, and all our allocations that the board has made. And this first statement, that's essentially what this does. It shows those resources, commitments, and for year-end, for the June 30th balances, there is a little bit a different line item on this report. The second line to the bottom says allocated in the six-year improvement program. Since we're using June 30th data, there are balances that, you know, unobligated balances that we took and we allocated back in June for fiscal year 2013. So that line on the bottom is unique to this quarter. So it's basically taken the excess, which is what I've told y'all quarter after quarter I want y'all to focus on as balances available for projects. And it's reducing that for what we already put into fiscal year 13 in the six-year program. And taking that bottom line and expanding on the detail of those balances, what you find is there's about $55 million in rail that's available. A large part of that was we got a one-time general fund transfer at the very end of the year for surplus revenues from 2011. So that caused that balance to be there. And additionally, we have some BTA 2000 funds that are there. Also that have certain restrictions placed on them as how they can be utilized. And then on the transit side, we're showing about a $30.7 million balance, and primarily that resulted from when we issued the bonds, the CPR bonds, in late May or early June. Mr. Lawson did such a great job a large premium was recognized, about $25 million, which accrued to transit. And that's also a part of the rail balance, too. It's smaller. It's around $5 to $7 million. Anyway, for y'all, this to me is one of the key points in the presentation and the update that I want y'all to keep these balances. So when you're pondering projects, these are the balances that as an agency and you as a board have to potentially go out and do something that isn't already in the six-year program. Our cash, we're working towards, y'all were speaking of a 60-day balance with Mr. Lawson. That's the target we're using on the transit side. On the rail side, there's more volatility because we have a lot fewer projects and the dollar volumes of those projects are a lot larger. So we're not timing the cash flows is a lot more difficult for those projects, so we've actually set a target of 90 days. And on the transit side, what you're seeing here, the transit side, and you'll see in the next couple of slides, we've done a pretty good job of being around that 60-day balance. But on the rail side, this past year, we've constantly been a lot higher. This just shows the balances over 18 months, and the main thing I'll show you here is the little blip at the end there is that $28 million that came in from the general fund at year end. But on the rail side, as I was saying, essentially it's four times higher than that target of $28 million. And what's called that is we have the Southampton Roads and Norfolk passenger train project. That originally when we did our estimates of cash flows, we were hoping that maybe that project could be up and running in May of 2012. And, projects are complicated, so various reasons we're targeting December of 2012. And a lot of the larger expenditures are backloaded in that project. So on a $110 million project, that's, throughout this presentation, there's a lot of items, but essentially that one project is driving a lot of the cash balance, and then later you'll see that our budgeted expenditures didn't quite meet what we were thinking either. But the last bullet here says that hopefully we put in better management processes. I know on the transit side, we did this year take a look at all projects greater than $500,000 and work with our grantees to get a definitive cash flow for the fiscal year. In prior years, we're sort of using just historical spend patterns. So we are trying to further our processes to refine these estimates. That being said, the next slide is the our budget action, which is taking the budget y'all approved. Y'all approved 2013 in June, but last year's budget, and this is sort of a final update on where we ended up with relation to that budget. And I think the document you have shows more detail in the financial update report, but this is sort of summarized. And what you'll see here is primarily in the public transit program, there was we misestimated the capital expenditures. Primarily it was some old bond expenditures that, as I just said, we kind of took historical spend rates, applied them to some of these old bond allocations, and assumed 100% spend rate, and then those projects didn't advance. So hopefully by looking at all the projects specifically rather than making that broad assumption, the current year budget will be more accurate in that arena. And in the rail programs, it's the same issue with the Norfolk train that just hasn't progressed at the speed we originally thought. And I guess finally, we did make on Dulles, the Dulles project, we did make that final payment that I spoke about at our last board meeting. It was $11 million of an old allocation of bond funding that did go out in the last quarter. With that, I'll take any questions that anyone has.
Any questions?
Thank you very much. Next is the RPP business plan. Ms. Drake?
Can you hit that one? It's coming out. Okay, I'm going to just put it down. There you are.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Thank you for the opportunity to come and discuss DRPT's business plan with you. It provides a detailed explanation of our work plan over the coming year. It's based on V-Trans 2035 Action Report, Governor's Multimodal Strategic Plan, and the Commonwealth Policy Goals for Transportation. Our priority areas are implementing and planning for rail and transit service, focusing on funding opportunities to maximize Virginia's investment in rail and transit, and improving our technical assistance and program efficiency through grantee training programs, enhancing planning tools, automating systems, and streamlining our DRPT processes. Our results, we've completed 2 transit feasibility studies and started 4 new transit systems. We are engaged in the Dulles Corridor Metro Rail Project. Phase 1 is scheduled to be completed at the end of 2013 and in revenue service in early 2014. And Phase 2, as you've heard a lot about, they've now gone out for their request for qualifications based on the Loudoun vote recently that it's moving ahead. In regards to the Norfolk Tide, we support that project. We also provide the safety oversight for it. Service began August of last year, doing very, very well. 46,000 riders for our off-sale weekend during June, and often breaks 5,000 riders a day. So we're very pleased to see that. On the freight side, Heartland Corridor and Commonwealth Railway Median Rail Line are complete. National Gateway and Crescent Corridor work continues, and studies we're involved in. Very interesting study, the Supernova, as we've named it, to do all of Northern Virginia, Transit and TDM Vision Plan, I-66 Corridor, High-Speed Rail Development, Broad Street Corridor here in Richmond, and the analysis and environmental assessment studies that are taking place. On the side of federal awards, I'm happy to report to you that our $75 million ERA award for an 11-mile track, third track in the Quantico area, we are now negotiating with FRA. We have sent them our changes to the agreement, and they have sent back very quickly, in like a day's time, some comments. So we're going back and forth. Our award to do the study for Richmond to D.C. has been on hold based on getting a record of decision into Norfolk and how we would take that extension, whether it went into Norfolk or Newport News. I actually signed the record of decision just this morning before I came over here. It has to go to FRA for their signature, but we think that we've got that finalized and we're very excited about it. Both of these projects we expect to be underway by the end of 2012. We continue to work on our transit development plans and long-range transportation demand management plans, our rail policies and procedures manual. We have what's called OLGA 4, that's the fourth version, that's our online grant application, and Symphony, which is grant management, so that our grantees can go online and do those applications. And we also have been engaged in an asset management program. It was a grant from the federal government to look at the life cycle of our buses. Are you buying buses at the right time, or do we need to anticipate a large number? We would actually, with this information, which is now in the transportation bill going to be something implemented across the nation, be able to ask a transit company, we think your buses are getting too old. How come you're only buying 4? So to be able to have better asset management of when capital expenditures are going to take place. Also, the launch of the extension of our Richmond train to Norfolk, we have now set the date. First train will be 12-12 of this year. The inaugural train party day will be December 11th of this year. Be a big party in Norfolk after that train arrives. Tickets are not on sale yet. We expect them to be by the end of this month, as Amtrak has to sell them in advance. We are completing our 297 study that you've heard a bit about, which are recommendations to the Assembly. You will hear a presentation on that a little bit later in your agenda. This is a preliminary presentation. It's a year and a half worth of work, and there is still stakeholder meetings that will take place, but you're going to hear about that shortly. We do, of course, continue to talk about the fact that we do not have a designated revenue source for passenger rail operations. We're very fortunate that we do have 3 years of funding. Today, Virginia trains, Amtrak Virginia, run in the black, but October 1 of 13 is when the new federal rules kick into place and we go from running into black to needing to subsidize our trains. We're also advancing regional studies in Northern Virginia to provide transit and TDM recommendations for key corridors in the region. And again, big for us, probably our number one issue remains making sure that we have a way to continue to run our trains after PREA kicks in. And, of course, implementing new Amtrak service and advancing our high-speed rail initiative, and also advancing freight rail capacity improvements statewide to take trucks off the highways and certainly to drive economic development. And on the technical side, to complete our online grants administration and internal grants management systems I mentioned, improve our performance management systems, and continuing to conduct financial compliance reviews for the use of state funds in BRPT's rail and transit programs. So our business plan initiatives, they're organized within the agency by agency division. We have two, finance and administration, and rail and transit we've put under Kevin Page over this year as part of our reorganization. But examples include, of course, our online grants. That's big for us to make it easier for grantees and easier across the board. To develop and implement a comprehensive marketing plan for our Amtrak Virginia service, really with emphasis as well on that Norfolk train. And one of them, as I told you, I think we hit today to achieve our federal record of decision for our Richmond-Hampton Roads Tier 1 and to complete our 297 study. So, Mr. Chairman, that completes my report, and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Ms. Drake?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Ellis.
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner Drake, for making this presentation this morning. Just wanted to ask, have you seen an increase in the number of grant applications since you've applied the OLBA system and Symphony? Or is it just streamlined the process?
It's streamlining the process, because the way our funding comes down, it's all formula-driven. Based on the amount of funds that we have this year, we're happy to report that this year we are going from 18 to 20% operating assistance, and our capital has gone from 50 to 55%. So, but it streamlines the process.
Yes, Ms. Coleman.
Director Drake, thank you. My question relates to our goals going forward in terms of operating expenses for transit. Do you see budget constraints not allowing us to do more in that area, or is there a possibility that that's still a preferred option in terms of applying some of the additional funds that we may have?
Well, I think you're going to hear more in the 297 study. We have Mark Aish here with us today, and that has been a real focus of VRPT, probably the biggest transit study the agency has ever undertaken. Because I think all of you are asking the same questions. How are we spending taxpayer dollars? Are we getting the best bang for the buck? What's the accountability? What's the performance? And what are the real needs? And that's what we're engaged in right now. And again, that'll be a preliminary report.
Very good. Thank you.
Sure. Yes. With respect to Dulles Rail, the $6 billion figure, does that include operating?
No. That is construction.
And has any pot of money been identified for operations and maintenance?
Well, the operations will work like they do today on the Virginia portion of the Metro system, which is the state provides operating assistance and capital assistance. This year, our contribution for existing Metro, not counting our $50 million, is $104 million. So $154 million is going into the current Metro system from the state. And then local governments also contribute to that operating subsidy and capital.
How much would we need for Dulles Rail?
I haven't gotten that far yet. We've been concentrating on how to get the project constructed.
All right. Thanks.
Yes, Director, yes. Another question for you. Did you say we had 46,000 riders?
Over Oxdale weekend.
Okay, that was over 3 days, am I correct?
Yes. 46,000 riders. We went downtown for a dinner and were able to park in the World Trade Center garage, and the top two floors were empty. And I asked the girl, I said, what's going on here? Why is there so few cars? She said they all came on light rail.
Right, right.
So, well, and they also ran buses so that you didn't have to wait as long for the light rail to come. HRT was very prepared, did a very good job.
Are we seeing those types of daily numbers, let's say, during like a tight game or something like that?
Yeah, daily numbers are anywhere from the mid-4,000 range to 5,000, where the original projections were 2,900.
Right.
So it's doing very, very well.
Right. And then how about like just see, like doing a baseball game, you know?
Yeah, I don't get them by day. I get them just sort of a weekly average.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be able to tie it to a ball game without looking at it at each day and knowing when a ball game was. But if I'm going to a ball game, that's the way I'm going to go.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thank you very much. We'll now have a presentation on moving ahead for progress in the 21st century. Assistant Secretary Strader.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm Matt Strader. I'm the Assistant Secretary of Transportation. I know the Secretary is looking forward to finally having got me over here to do a presentation. This is my first one.
Well, this may be your first and last, depending on what you do.
No pressure.
Maybe you have to break the end.
You have to double click it, Mr. Strader. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Secretary of Transportation.
All right, as I'm sure most of you are aware, on July 6th, President Obama signed into law a new two-year surface transportation authorization, commonly referred to as MAP 21. My little disclaimer here, the bill is only about 2 weeks old, and in many cases, most of the new provisions will require interpretation and or rulemakings from FHWA and FRA and FTA. So I will try to answer as many of your questions as best as I possibly can, and Mr. Walton and his staff will certainly have follow-up presentations as the true impact and implications of the new provisions are known. The legislation extends safety loop through the end of this federal fiscal year, so these new provisions will begin taking effect on October 1st. And thereafter, it's a two-year, $105 billion authorization. Among other things, the legislation expands the TIFIA program and other innovative financing mechanisms, consolidates highway and transit programs, provides reforms to accelerate the project delivery process, establishes a national freight policy, national freight network, mandates implementation of performance measures and targets, which we will cover extensively, enhances highway safety, and maintains and modernizes transit programs. As I mentioned, it's $105 billion for FY13 and FY14. It extends the HTF and tax collections through FY16. Give us a couple more years in that regard. The equity bonus program is eliminated. However, the legislation guarantees 95% return on the state's highway trust fund contributions. Continues the 80-20 highway transit funding split, transfers $18.8 billion in general funds to the highway trust fund over the life of the authorization. The largest portion of that money comes from changes to defined benefit plans. Not my area of expertise, but apparently it will lead to companies reporting more taxable income. Congressional Budget Office estimates that by FY2015, the Highway Trust Fund will still face new deficits following this authorization. MAP 21 eliminates all allocations, all allocation formulas based on lane mileage and vehicle miles traveled. So the way that the funding works is for FY13, states are held harmless at not less than FY12 levels. And then for FY14, there's a small inflationary factor, and then we're guaranteed 95% of return on highway use taxes. The allocations amongst programs for both TMAC and Metropolitan Planning, they come off the top at a proportion of 2009 levels compared to the total allocations for that year. National Highway Performance Program is 63.7% of the remainder, surface transportation 29.3%, and then highway safety 7%. On the right side, you can see kind of just a brief comparison between Safety Lou and Map 21. One thing to note is Map 21 does not include any congressional earmarks.
So what happened to the earmarks that already existed?
It's a good question, Mr. Chairman. We'll get back to you on that one.
Not starting out very well, Mr. Strang.
On this slide, you can just kind of see a brief overview of how the funding breaks down amongst the various programs on the highway side. Move through these relatively quickly. Same thing for the transit side of things. And these are all initial estimates from FHWA and FTA. So what does this mean for Virginia? Based upon FHWA and FRA estimates, you can see for 2013 that $985,698,122, that does not include the transit portion, but I included the amount we're looking at for transit down in that last bullet, about $119 million for transit. For 2014, a little bit more, $994 million in change, with $120 million in change for transit. As I mentioned, it expands the TIFIA program pretty substantially. For FY13, it will be $750 million. For FY14, it will be $1 billion, and that's up from $122 million in Safety Lou. MAP 21 increases the amount of a project cost that can be funded with loans to 49% as opposed to the current 33. It expands the repayment period on a TIFIA loan from 35 years to the life of the asset. It also creates a kind of a new category of loan. Not more than 10% of the authorization is to be set aside each year for rural infrastructure projects. These are projects defined as any surface transportation project located in an area other than a city with a population of more than 250,000 inhabitants. For the rural project, the eligible project cost floor is reduced from $50 million to $25 million. There's also a new project readiness standard. Basically, if FHW or USDOT approves your TIFIA loan, you have to be able to demonstrate that the project can begin to move forward within 90 days. There are also new approval deadlines and a rolling approval process. The Secretary will notify you once your application is complete within 30 days of receipt, and then notify you of approval or denial within 60 days thereafter. Also, under Safety Lou, there are a number of somewhat subjective evaluation criteria. Basically, those have been eliminated. If your project, if you meet the application guidelines, you meet the $50 million, you have your letters of credit, you'll be approved basically on a first-come, first-served basis. Tolling. This is one area where we still need to do a little bit more digging and see exactly what FHWA is going to say and how they're going to interpret it, but a good way to look at tolling under MAP 21 is basically any portion of the interstate system or the national highway system, you can toll so long as the number of free lanes after the project is complete remains the same as before, which isn't really clear exactly how it's going to work. You can also reconstruct a tunnel or a bridge and then turn that into a toll facility. The bill clarifies that federal funds can be used for converting HOV lanes into hot lanes, provided that the MPO has concurred, you're using all electronic tolling, and the state has written policies on variable tolling and toll enforcement. Another aspect of the tolling portions of the legislation are that within 4 years, all toll collection nationwide has to be interoperable.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Cole and Mr. Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Strader. It's my understanding that the IMF, the Interstate Maintenance Funds, and the National Highway Systems have been merged in this bill?
That's correct.
So how does that affect maintenance monies that had previously gone to a toll portion of an interstate? You know, as it stands today, those monies will be moved to other interstates within the state.
Right.
Do we have a focus on what that's going to do to the potential I-95?
I would say not at this point. the eligibilities for tolling are expanded. You can use federal funding in a lot more instances under MAP 21. But again, I think how that would impact 95 will depend on exactly how that project moves forward, because as I said, there is a requirement that, you know, 95 various parks have either two or three free lanes right now. As I understand the legislation, you would still have to have those two or three lanes in addition to whatever lanes you were tolling. So I'm not really sure how that'll work. Plus, it didn't make any changes to the existing pilot program. So exactly how that'll all break out will really depend on how FHWA interprets these new statutes.
And when might you expect to hear?
It's my understanding from Mr. Walton spoke that the agencies are just now starting to sit down and game plan on what they have to do, you know, vis-a-vis interpreting the bill, vis-a-vis rulemaking. You know, the legislation, as I said, doesn't even go into effect until August 1st or October 1st, and in many cases, you know, there are rulemaking periods of up to a year, 18 months, and then states have a year on top of that to put in place all the new policies to comply with the rulemaking. So in a lot of respects, we're a long way off probably from understanding all of the true implications of the various aspects of MAP 21.
Sounds like Dodd-Frank all over again.
It was a very, very enthralling read, I must say.
Mr. Lane.
My question, Chairman, is really a general way of asking what Mr. Cole did. That these provisions will be prospectively applied, such that things that are in place now or any actions we've taken will not be impacted. Is that basically?
It depends, Mr. Lane, on exactly how FHWA interprets certain aspects of the bill. And I'll point out a few as we move throughout the next couple sections of the presentation. But, you know, the polling folks from VDOT have said that this really should not impact the 95 tolling project, for example.
Right. Okay.
One of the major aspects of MAP 21 is the program consolidation. Approximately 60 different federal highway programs are eliminated or consolidated, and then much of the funding is focused on core programs. Those core programs are the National Highway Performance Program, the Surface Transportation Program, CMAQ, Highway Safety, Metropolitan Planning, and then Transportation Alternatives.
Mr. Chair, what are Transportation Alternatives? What does that mean?
Transportation Alternatives is a new program that consolidates the enhancements, safe routes to school, and recreational trails all into one program where there's flexibility in moving those funds around. It's funded with a 2% set aside of apportioned funds. Requires 50% to be sub-allocated based on population, and then 50% can be used wherever in the state. MPOs with a population greater than 200,000 select their project out of their sub-allocated funds. And then there is flexibility throughout a number of these new programs. States can transfer up to 50% of their non-sub-allocated funds to those that aren't required to go to specific urbanized areas to other programs. A few additional notes about the transportation alternatives. The eligibilities have changed somewhat, and there do appear to be two categories of enhancements that are no longer eligible. Those are scenic or historic sites and establishment of transportation museums. The six basic areas of eligibility under the new program are on and off-road pedestrian and bike facilities, safe routes for non-drivers, conversion of abandoned rail corridors to trails, turnouts, overlooks, viewing areas, community improvement activities, and environmental mitigation. So really three things could happen with this program as it relates to the enhancements. One, FHWA could say the FY13 enhancements are just left intact. We'll make the changes next year. Projects that are currently underway could be grandfathered in which case there would be two new projects that may no longer be eligible, the Jamestown-Yorktown-Middle applications and Gilbert's Corner Scenic Historic Property Acquisition. And then the third option would be FHWA strictly interprets the bill. On October 1, we would have to make some changes to our enhancement allocations. And then you start looking at a much broader scope of projects. Robert Russa Morton Museum, UVA Bike Share, Shenandoah Valley Battlefields, the statewide pedestrian bicycle safety guide, Civil War Preservation Trust. Some of those things could potentially be on the chopping block depending on how the legislation is interpreted and when FHWA decides.
But they could be grandfathered, possibly.
Some of them could be grandfathered, some of them could not. They could decide to leave the whole thing intact and say, we'll make these changes for the next year for the allocations. No way to tell at this point.
Will we at a certain point be responding to some of these questions that are still lingering in the regulatory field by sending a letter or something?
Yes. Mr. Walton and his staff, in almost every one of these changes, there's an opportunity for state DOTs to comment, to work with FHWA. I know that they will be reaching out and getting the interpretation and guidance that they need in all the various areas.
It might be good to give the board a draft so we can have some kind of a input in that.
A number of other things to point out. This slide really just kind of shows you how some of the larger programs have been consolidated into the newer programs. A couple of other areas to note. Under the National Highway Performance Program, states are going to be required to develop a risk-based asset management plan for the entirety of the national highway system to include a list of assets and condition, asset management objectives and measures, performance gap identification, life cycle cost, financial plan, and investment strategies. This will likely entail a pretty large expansion of VDOT's current maintenance asset management plan. Under the surface transportation program, there are a number of new eligibilities, such as carpooling, parking facilities, alternative vehicle infrastructure, safety infrastructure, congestion pricing, intermodal projects. The funding breakdown for STP is changing a little bit. The 10% set aside for enhancements is obviously gone since that's been rolled into the transportation alternative. So now basically 50% of the program will go to urbanized areas and 50% will go to anywhere in the state, as opposed to the old STP formula, which was 10% enhancement, 62.5 urbanized, and then 37.5 anywhere. Off-system bridges is thrown in with the surface transportation program. That requires a 15% set-aside. However, that can be adjusted by the secretary at a state's request. And there are credits built in for using state funds on off-system bridges. Another area where there could be implications, and again, this is something that Mr. Walton and his environmental folks are looking at, is CMAQ. One new requirement is urbanized areas of 1 million plus are required to have performance plans. And the initial analysis shows that the program as a whole could be affected, given some changes to attainment versus non-attainment for Hampton Roads, Fredericksburg, and Richmond area. So once we get further guidance, there could be some pretty significant changes coming to the CMAQ allocation. Project delivery. One of the things that they've really tried to highlight with MAP 21 is a number of improvements in the project delivery environmental streamlining area. However, the majority of these changes are things that VDOT already does through agreements with the FHWA division office or are part of FHWA's Everyday Counts initiative. And it's also important to remember that, you know, the MAP 21 really focuses on NEPA, but there are over 50 other federal environmental-oriented regulations that have an impact on timelines and costs for developing these projects. But just a couple of examples of things that are included in the legislation. They expand categorical exclusions to include any emergency replacement projects, projects within the right-of-way, projects with limited amounts of federal funding, and certain multimodal projects involving ports. States are given more flexibility to begin certain activities prior to NEPA completion, early acquisition of right-of-way, design, entering into construction manager, general contractor, two-phase contracts, which is essentially a contracting method between the traditional design, bid, build, and design, build. So it kind of just falls right in the middle.
Mr. Chairman, Rich, do you think, what about the some of the hydrology requirements? Does that come in this categorical exclusion? I noticed in my district in very small roads with very, you know, low volume, it looks like FHWA makes them put in this huge, much larger bridge, and it's more expensive than we need because of the 100-year flood thing. Can we get out from under some of that through this, do you think?
Possibly, if it's within the existing right-of-way, or if there's limited federal funds.
You have to meet all those dots?
No, you don't have to meet all of those dots. You just have to meet one.
Okay.
But again, you know, a lot of that will come down to a per project basis on what they'll require and not require. But generally, they have expanded categorical exclusions.
Thank you.
Some of the others, there are now going to be federal agency deadlines for review, kind of 180 days after you submit your complete NEPA. And there will be penalties upon the federal agencies for not meeting those deadlines. The statute of limitations for legal challenges are reduced from 180 days to 150. Support programmatic approaches, something GDOT already does, and expands the applicability of state delegation pilot program to include all states. California is really the only state that ever took advantage of the pilot program. It's not something we've really been interested in because it would require us to waive sovereign immunity. Map 21 also establishes a new national freight policy. Within 1 year, the Secretary will be responsible for designating a new national freight network. Then within 3 years, USDOT will develop a national freight strategic plan. One of the benefits of this new program is that USDOT will be able to increase the federal share from 90 to 95% for projects on the interstate and from 80 to 90% for any other freight projects. However, those projects have to be identified in the state freight plan, and you have to be able to demonstrate progress towards meeting the performance targets, which we're getting ready to talk about in a moment. It also encourages states to establish a state freight plan and a freight advisory committee. So one of the things that will probably need to happen is VDOT will need to sit down and identify which projects may qualify for this. They'll need to review the statewide multimodal freight study to determine if it meets the criteria laid out in Map 21. If it does, great. If not, consider what amendments need to be made, and then consider reconvening the Virginia Freight Advisory Committee, which helped put together that study. One of the major new requirements in Map 21 is going to be the implementation of national performance standards. The legislation sets out 7 broad goals in safety, infrastructure condition, congestion reduction, system reliability, freight movement and economic vitality, environmental sustainability, and reduced project delivery delays. Based upon these national goals, USDOT, in consultation with state DOTs, stakeholders, et cetera, will have 18 months to establish high-level performance measures. States will have 90 days to comment on those once they're put together. Once FHWA completes its rule, or USDOT completes the rulemaking on their performance measures, then states will have 1 year to develop specific targets that are needed to meet those broader measures. And then MPOs will be required to adopt targets in coordination with the state 180 days after the state adopts its targets. These performance measures and demonstrating progress towards meeting them are going to have to be implemented in long-range plans, TIPs, STIPs, so basically all of the planning documents moving forward. Obviously, once all these time frames occur, are going to have to be updated and include new aspects in regards to the performance measures. Just a couple quick bullets on metropolitan and statewide planning. Retains the requirement MPOs be established for urbanized areas over 50,000 or more. States are given the option of designating regional transportation planning organizations in non-metropolitan areas. They made a word change that states are required to develop long-range plans in cooperation with rather than in consultation with. transportation officials in non-metropolitan areas. MTOs over 200,000 are required to have representatives of public transit operators. And then in non-attainment areas, federal funds will now be able to be used for new capacity for single occupant vehicles, provided the project is addressed through a congestion management process, which is basically a kind of regional congestion management plan. And again, obviously the major new requirement is that all the various plans will have to account for the performance measures and targets. Real briefly, highway safety funding is doubled. Most existing requirements are retained. USDOT will establish performance measures. If states fail to update strategic plans, penalty is ineligibility for August redistribution of funds. High-risk rural roads set aside is eliminated, provided that you do not have an increase in fatalities over a two-year period. Highway grade crossing program continues at current levels, slight increase in NHTSA program, and basically there's a new incentive program in the form of grants for programs for occupant protection, impaired driving, traffic records, graduated licensing, et cetera. Transit, same thing, program retained at roughly the same level, same length, reduces the number of discretionary programs. JARC new freedom programs consolidated into existing formula programs, bus facilities program distributed by formula, new state of good repair program to replace the fixed guideway modernization program, establishes a new category for core capacity improvement within new starts. Elderly and disabled program is formalized with 60% going to large urbanized areas, 20% to small, and 20% to others. Changes in the fixed guideway definition to include HOV lanes, thereby reducing assistance for transit systems that operate bus services on HOV hot lanes. There is an exception, I believe, that just unless that operator operates more than 100,000 buses in a day, or not 100,000, excuse me, 100 buses per day. No changes to the allowable commuter benefit, so there's still the disparity between transit and parking benefits. Administration and oversight for rural formula grant program reduced from 15 to 10%. The secretary will establish safety and state of good repair performance measures, requires recipients of funding to develop a transit asset management plan and system, similar to what VDOT will have to do for roads. And then allows transit agencies operating and over communities over 200,000 to use a portion of their formula operating assistance if they operate less than 100 buses during rush hour. And then finally, USDOT is to create a national safety plan for all transit modes. That's all I got for you.
So go back to 19. So what does that mean about the changes to guideway definition exclude HOV lanes?
Basically, if a transit system operates bus services on HOV hot lanes, we'll get less money. Perhaps Director James can explain a little more detail, or we can get back to you on that one. Or
I think your page showed up.
Just in time delivery. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Currently today, some of our transit providers run up and down fixed guideway systems, which are the restricted HOV lanes or hot lanes. There's been a change in that guidance, which they would potentially be ineligible for the fixed guideway funding allocations that they receive, the credits for operating in a fixed guideway system environment.
Why? So what's the thinking behind it?
I can't speak to the lawmakers, sir, but we've questioned that same thought as well. Hopefully when we see the notice of proposed rulemaking coming out as to how that could be implemented, we can better address our concerns on that. And hopefully under the NPRM process, we can go back to the Fed and try to help mold that so that there is as much maximum flexibility as we can put into it based on how the law has been handled.
Well, one of our big motivations in supporting the 495 HST lane is for the first time we're going to be able to run transit buses on the Beltway. First time ever.
Correct.
So now in doing that, they tell us they don't want us to run buses on the HOV, HOT.
interpretation of that 21 is that that is the case, and we hope that the NPRM, when it comes out, we can address that and hopefully work towards some variances to how that policy is implemented. It's left us shaking our heads as well, sir.
Matt, thanks a lot for this update. I think we were all wanting to know what was behind this authorization bill. I would ask Mr. Secretary or Mr. Chairman that Matt come back as needed or on a quarterly basis, because the bogeys are going to keep popping up here, and some may be major. And I did reference Dodd-Frank because that's exactly what's happened to the banking community if there's a parallel with this authorization bill, that every day something new is going to come out, and sometimes it can have a major implication that we need to know about if it affects what we have to do with CTV. So I know this is a to be continued, but we need that information.
I think what Ms. Garzinski is asking, like, should we, did he do well enough that we should have him back again? Or what do you think? Yeah. You know, with your old Romans, it was, Don't let it get to his head. Yes,
Chairman, if you go to the next slide, there's a reference to the State of Good Repair Performance Measure for Transit.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because there haven't been common definitions of those things, or it needs to be updated, or is that a sort of a unique thing that applies to transit that doesn't apply any place else?
Just, I know from our involvement in working with committee staff and our delegation and other Congress members involved in the authorization process, from the get-go, one of the goals was to, across all modes and all systems, impose new performance measures.
So the State of Good Repair is just, it's sort of
one of the transit performance measures. Yeah.
Well, I noticed earlier on slide 16 when you talked about, in general, there's no reference to that being a part, say, of the National Highway System or whatever, but we assume that it's in there as well.
Yes, I mean, a State of Good Repair is, I mean, essentially the same thing. It's the transit version of, you know, how many potholes do you have on the highway.
So it mirrors a lot of the things we already do. Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
And then, I'm sorry, you started out with the bonus equity program's gone away?
Equity bonus has gone away. That's the program that kind of, well, I don't want to say guaranteed, but helped ensure that states got this fair share of their transportation trust fund contributions back. They eliminated that program, and now it's just flat requirement that a state get 95% of its contribution to the highway trust fund back.
But I thought part of the bonus equity was when other states don't spend, if we met our obligation,
that was a different piece of it.
So is all the bonus equity gone, or only a piece that?
It's my understanding that's done away with, but given the 95% level, we will still be basically getting the same amount we would have gotten in that by 13.
Well, but what I'm asking is that, so when states are not able to meet performance criteria or spend the money, will we still be able to please get?
Yes.
Yes.
Ms. Martin, did you?
Thank you. You mentioned recently that the MPO role in performance measurements and other things for the MPOs of 200,000 or more. Do you have any insight as to the future of smaller MPOs?
Not really. I'll have to get back and look at the legislation.
Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment. I think probably overall this, if we look past that this is a stopgap measure, in other words, it's basic extension of what we have, number one, in terms of funding. But I think there's two things that potentially make the board and then make the Commonwealth and VDOT and DRPT more responsive going forward. One is the flexibility that's built in Now, by combining some of the categorical programs that we've always wrung our hands about, that even if we didn't need the money ourselves for that, we had to spend the money for that. So that flexibility. The second is sort of the streamlining of some of the approval processes that cut down not only some of the requirements, but certainly the time that's involved in getting these projects actually begun and going. And, for example, with concurrent review of NEPA requirements allows you to proceed as quickly as you can as opposed to as slowly as possible. So I see that as potentially making the board and the departments much more responsive, even if the funds aren't necessarily significantly more.
Jim? Director, following up with Mr. Coleman, maybe the staff, after they've had a time to look at this thing, can really give us an overview as to the good and the bad, because it doesn't appear that it's all bad, but there is some bad, and that we can have that type of information. And with respect to the bad stuff, that we highlight that,
and then are able to go to the federal delegation and say, you know, sorry about that.
Maybe do something about it. The other question that I had was, since most of our state our maintenance is done with state funds, we can get out from under all of that when we use state money. Is that correct? We don't have to go through all of this stuff, this federal stuff with state maintenance funds?
Yes, sir. Typically, I mean, if you're using just state money on a project, you can avoid most of the federal requirements.
The financial underpinning of this thing seems to be done by a lot of people say are gimmicks, you know, fiddling around with pensions. How is that scored? If the money isn't coming in, actually, is some of the funding in jeopardy over the next 2 years? Or do they just kind of go through the facade that the money's coming in? Is the scoring allow them to do that so we don't have to worry about a loss of funding within the next 2 years? Or do we still have to worry about that?
Mr. Chairman, I think the question was, you know, this is the budget as approved. The question is, if the funding that revenue actually received at the federal level is less than what this budget says, will we get a budget amount? It's my understanding we'll be getting the budget amount, not based upon what's actually received in the trust fund.
Thank you. So if they fall short with actual federal revenues with this pension funding gimmick, then the funding that we get, the appropriated funding, could be reduced, right?
Why would that be any different than the last 10 years with the deficit? The deficit gets bigger. I think that's the answer is what happens.
They just borrow from China and we go on.
Have another QE3 or anyway. But
Mr. Chairman, I would think that the ramifications of that would come down the road. And as I understand, it's a 27-month spending project that is funded by 120 months worth of funding. So I don't think in the first 27 months we're going to run short or under budget. You know, they'll just raise the projections of what will come in the remaining 70-plus months. So I think that if there are deleterious effects, it'll come the next time around or two bills down the road.
Yeah, I think you're correct, Mr. Cole, that when you get back to the start of the authorization process, the Senate was always looking at a two-year bill at current levels and covering the gap with the general fund, whereas the House started out with, I believe, a five-year bill or six-year bill that specifically tied allocations to what was in the HDF. So under that circumstance, you would have had a lot more risk of, you know, fluff each year in terms of the funding. I think, not to speculate too much or speak for the negotiators, but the compromise is basically, you know, get as many of the House policy reforms as you could into the authorization and then get the Senate on the funding side for the most part, which, as I said, will, you know, 2 years from now, by the time most of these provisions go into effect, you're going to be back in the same position of another extension or a new authorization at a point where the Highway Trust Fund is in much worse fiscal shape than, you know, based on current projections than it is today.
Which sort of
highlights a certain a big problem we face, is that so much of this law is going to have to be implemented through regulatory changes.
Yes.
But it's only a two-year bill, and those who are experienced with the federal regulatory process, they'll just be getting around to issuing notices of proposed rulemaking.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the
bill ends up ending.
You look at the performance measures, operate October 1st, start date, 18 months to put out the rulemaking, and then another year after that for the states to implement it, and then another 180 days. The authorization's expired by the time those are even, you know, going into effect. So
you got to question whether the bill itself is a sham, because so much of it's going to end up having to be implemented through regulatory changes, which will not even
built in
potentially get on the street before they get out to the public comment before this bill ends.
Mr. Chairman, does that mean that we can spend according to prior regulations, the new money, and not have to fool with this?
Well, I think they're going to have to issue interim. No, I don't know. I mean, the old law is gone. I mean,
as of October 1st, the old law is gone.
Invalid based on one of the new provisions, wherever they happen to be, went into effect, whether immediately or on October 1st. The bigger problem is that, okay, so you did away with the current regulatory scheme. You have a new law, but a lot of it, and how they're going to interpret it, is really going to be defined by new regulation. So my assumption is that the out there are going to have to issue some interim guidelines, but even that's going to be messy. Unless they go and issue emergency regulations, which I would some things they may have to do.
In some things I think they probably can do that, and others there are specific timelines laid out that they have to follow.
Well, Mr. Chairman, wasn't there some grandfathering, I believe, with some of the projects that used to be grandfathered in?
Those are potential scenarios that could occur within the transportation alternatives. Which scenario FHWA will go with remains to be seen. I mean, if you apply the law literally, then all of those projects are gone, and you're going to have to go back to the drawing board on the, at least, you know, the enhancement projects that are no longer eligible, which will probably involve also bringing in the MPOs and letting them pick some projects as well. Then again, you could grandfather existing projects and you'd only lose two new projects that haven't begun, or they could say, we understand we've already doled out this money for this year, new provisions are going to start in for the 2014 round of enhancement.
Well, what we're talking about then, how does this affect the revenue sharing program, if it does at all?
Yeah, the revenue sharing is all state funds.
Okay, so we wouldn't, no impact with that. Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, do we have the staff to deal with all of this? I mean, who's going to deal with all of this?
This might be a question for Commissioner Worley.
He still has some free time on Sunday evening, so he can have
it. Mr. Chairman, this is where we have to remind ourselves it's already a mess. This is a mess, potentially, but it's already a mess. I mean, we already have staff that's tied up. I don't know if you saw the defense. There was a study of the defense budget that was released earlier this week. They estimated 20% of the defense costs are actually this overhead administrative detail audit, you know, absolutely advancing very little of the mission. And I'm sure we've got that kind of number in this area, too.
Because every time there's another scandal, they have another level of review, which is still somebody who wants to steal money or do something bad, they still figure out a way to do it when they have another level of review. So
efficiency is like this relative term.
Yeah.
And there's parts of the Caribbean said it's more like guidelines. Really.
With that, Mr. Trader, very good job. Man, we will have you back maybe in a few months to follow up. With that, I'm going to ask Ms. Durrell to come up and tell us about the SAVE program and the sponsorships and naming rights.
Yes. Let's see. Is this it? It is. Well, hopefully we'll do something a little lighter, a little less complicated.
Memorial.
Okay. So just quickly, I'm going to talk, make a little presentation here about our new naming rights law and the CTB's duty. And we will be coming back to you later with a policy for you all to an action for you all to take. But wanted to just give you this opportunity to show you what the law has done. And FHWA has also reissued its policy order on sponsorships to make sure that we're not actually advertising on federal highways. And talk a little bit about some of our current initiatives and an overview of what we're thinking about for our draft guidelines and then sort of the next steps of where we're going here. So in the duties legislation for the CTB or the list of duties for the CTB, one of the things that was added was to allow you all to name things besides just highways and bridges and interchanges. So toll roads or tunnels or ferries or other things, I guess, you know, are now all everything is named to be named. And so obviously you would give us some funding in consideration of us putting your name on something. And you would have to pay, that would also uncover the cost of whatever signing might be involved. And there would not have to be any local resolutions from local boards of supervisors or city councils like they have been in others for the namings of bridges and things like that to do this particular kind of naming. And if something already has a name, and we have lots of roads, some of which have multiple names or bridges that already have names, the law requires that name to be incorporated into any new name you might give it. So that'll be interesting. The FHWA in March issued a new order on sponsorships, since more and more states are sort of getting into the business of sponsorships, and they didn't feel like maybe they had quite the structure that they wanted to have. So basically what they're telling all state DOTs is they should have a policy to govern their sponsorship and revenue program, and that we allow people, individuals, firms, or entities to sponsor parts of our operations through the provision of highway-related services, products, or monetary contributions. Any signing that we do to give them credit in for sponsorship has to be in line with current federal standards for signing, and agreements should have termination clauses for a variety of reasons, like safety, if for some reason we start having some kinds of problems with that. And the policy should be approved by the Federal Highway Administrator's state office, and that they are going to approve any individual agreements for sponsorships on interstates. So they want to see exactly what companies are being sponsored and what the sign and the logo looks like and all that sort of stuff. So we also prohibit any discrimination among the sponsoring organizations, and that all funds that are generated through sponsorship programs are used for a highway purpose. So before that law, that directive came out, there were other directives, but VDOT has had two initiatives that they started back toward the end of 2011. One was the revenue sponsorship program for the rest areas, which we've dubbed SAVE, which is sponsorships, advertising, and vending. So the sponsorship is where you would get a sign out on the road that could be seen by the public that would say that you were providing funds and helping to sponsor a flower bed or the rest area itself, even. Advertising, there is advertising allowed inside of the building where you can't see it from the road, and then the vending enhancements. If you stop at any of the rest areas, you might have recently seen that you can now buy a Virginia is the Lover's hat or t-shirt or teddy bear, those sorts of things, and apparently they're selling rather well. So then we also have had a contract to combine our video and data and have someone manage those contracts and the distribution of that to things like media outlets for traffic. And we think that we can get some revenue out of that through our 511 program primarily. So for the SAFE program, the goal was to offset part of the need to operate the rest areas, and so the services that generate revenue are managed through a contract and include all of that. So we've already got this under contract, and we're working with a company, and actually they've already brought us a company. We're going through the process today of having FHWA review and approve the signing. One of the things that we've done is to have a sliding scale percentage formula with minimum guarantees for us for revenue. The revenue is shared between VDOT, the Department of Visually Handicapped and the Blind, because they were running the vending program before, and also with the tourism agency for the travel advertising and brochures and types of things that they were getting out. So currently we're looking at it could be anywhere from about $2 to $4 million a year once it really gets up and running. Virginia has the unique position of actually having taken this program, our request to get signing on the interstate for the sponsorship sign, so it would be a mainline interstate sign, so it would be really worth something, and that actually had to go all the way to Secretary LaHood, but we did get that, and so that's opened the way for all states to have a sponsorship program signing on the interstate, which is going to help us generate a little more revenue than we would have otherwise. On the 511 revenues, this was a goal to create revenue to support our expanded 511 system and our traveler services programs. And so the new 511 services obviously include a new voice recognition system, response system for the phone, a new website, and a mobile app, if you haven't seen it. Nice little mobile app here that's available both on a Droid or an iPhone. And we have streaming video service, which is great, and the media stations are excited about that. And we also are going to have 511 signing. You may have seen there's some old signs that have been out on the interstate for a number of years, and they actually say travel services instead of traffic information. So we're changing them based on the customer service surveying that we've done to say, one, that VDOT is providing it, two, that it's traffic information to call 511, and there would be a sign underneath that that says sponsored by, you know, Marshmallow Incorporated or whoever it might be. So we actually have one company who wants to buy all of those signs. There's one company that wants to buy all of the rest area signs. But we're going to go from about 300 and some signs to about 500, one about every 5 miles, not creating too much signing on the road, but actually providing more opportunities for that. So the solicitations of sponsorships are underway, and there are a number of companies, national corporations, that are looking for opportunities to be connected with our traveler information services. Over the 5 years of the contract, we are hoping that, or expecting that we may get as much as $10 million over the 5 years. So just to show you a little bit about, you know, these various packages, depending on the road signing sponsorship, if you want 10 signs, 30 signs, 50 signs, all of these are going to be negotiated with potential sponsors, and we also may be selling them as in connection with other types of advertising, such as advertising that could be on the mobile app or on the web page. Most of the revenue, though, is going to come from signs. There's really not very much that's going to come from the electronic advertising. So that's what it would look like. Call VDOT traffic information, and it would be sponsored by whomever. So also one of the other things that we're looking at is we've included in a request for proposal that just went out with outsourcing our traffic operations centers and our safety service patrols and other functions, that when we do that, that company will also have the revenue sponsorship of the safety service patrols, and that we would get some additional funding for that. And there are two or three states currently that have this, and State Farm has been the company that has been sponsoring this in other places, but I'm sure there's some other companies that would like to get in this game. So for the naming rights draft policy guidelines, those will be presented to you in September. We're looking at establishing a VDOT governance board for namings, and that the policy would be interpreted and applied in accordance with all the federal laws, and that we're going to be hiring a consultant to help us establish some pricing and fees. The fees have to be approved by the CTB under the legislation. So depending on how we may either structure set fees or we may be able to do some negotiated fees, you know, as you would name things, you would be approving the fee that would be associated with it. So the preferred form of consideration for the naming rights, obviously, is monetary as opposed to services, and to try and maximize revenues to the Commonwealth and to support maintenance and operations and capital improvements. So in the they also would identify the entities that are eligible. So only a legal or registered name would be permitted is what we're thinking now. And the names aren't supposed to be connoted in or presented in a way to connote advertising. So it's not supposed to have your website on it or your telephone number or you know, the array of products you provide. Also, there would be exclusivity. No more than one private entity would be given naming rights, and that previous names would be incorporated as along with that naming. There are statutory prohibitions regarding name connotations and the termination events. There would be termination events and associated rights for reimbursement. So the next steps are to establish a sponsorship and naming rights program function. This would be housed in our maintenance division that would really oversee all of these revenue generating opportunities and provide oversight for all the sponsorship and naming initiatives. The maintenance division already is the organization that handles all the namings for all the bridges and that sort of thing today. So it would also maintain awareness of other states' programs and developments. We're looking at exploring a three-step strategy for legislative naming rights with marketing company expertise. So we perform a 60-day assessment of market potential, you know, what things really would be facilities that people would be willing to pay something to have their name put on. You think about it, it could well be like a billboard. So how many times are people going to go by it and see the name? Is it a part of a facility that's getting discussed when there are traffic reports, for example? So if you're in Chesapeake, you know, how many times do you hear a reference to the High Bridge? So instead of it being a High Bridge, could it be some other bridge? And because of the numbers of times it might get named, it might have some more value for someone to want to pay to have naming rights. So those are the kinds of things that we've been told by some of these companies that make them valuable. So we want to really take a look at what things we have in terms of what are the opportunities, which things really should we be out there promoting, and perform a pilot test to market the strategies and developing a pricing and cost strategy. We also want to review current legislative language and some proposed technical amendments to implement the naming rights once we find out a little bit more about what is going to be required. And we're going to be looking to hire a consultant to help support administering this program and the future expansion of it. So in the last slide here is just the list of the tasks we have to accomplish in order to finish writing the guidelines. We have to get FHWA approval, develop the market assessment and pilot, bring the guidelines to the CTB for your review and comment, and then final approval, report to the General Assembly committees on what we've done in this program area, and issue an RFP to get some support and then award that contract. So that's the end of my presentation.
Thanks. That's informative. A couple of questions. The signs that are going to be created for sponsorship, who pays for those signs?
The sponsor will pay for them.
So that's above and beyond the annual fee or whatever that he might put on there then?
Correct. Well, you know, it might be a one-time cost for 5 years or 10 years. You know, I know with some sports stadiums and other facilities, you know, a company might pay $10 million for 20 years or something like that to have their name put on the Verizon Center or the whatever Capital One Center or whatever it is, and that would include whatever, you know, the cost of whatever signing that would be needed and the maintenance of those signs.
With this effort that's going to be taking place, are we going to have to add more staff to do that? Or do we currently have staff that's doing similar type thing now?
We're going to be looking to hire a company to help us manage this. We don't currently have the staff to manage this program inside. No, not at this moment. We haven't done enough to figure out what that did. You know, we probably a couple of people, but you know, I don't think it's going to be a very large cost.
So the anticipated $10 million may be not a net figure, but a gross figure that is going to have
multiple
contractor
years.
And anyone else other figures.
Yeah, it could be over multiple years. It could be paid out in a number of ways. I mean, you know, we none of the other states have done this yet. I mean, they're looking at it. Florida and Ohio are the other two states that that I've been in contact with that are the only ones that are really actively pursuing it. They've got contracts either out to procure a company to help them, or they already have a company and they're doing an inventory of their assets and really trying to figure out which ones have value. So, yeah, this is a pretty new area.
Ms. Lane?
Chair, mine's more of a comment. Our first action item this afternoon is for whenever we get to it, is a memorial naming of a bridge for somebody who supposedly did something in valor or specific to get a named bridge at them. Now we're going to turn around and we're going to say, but if you've got enough money, we'll be happy to name a bridge after you. I mean, I just question what are we doing here in total for the amount of revenues that are. But I can just see south of the border all the way down and big signs that Virginia is for sale. So my comment is, I understand the floodplain, we have to deal with it, but I think we cannot see the forest for the trees. We are spending time on these measures, administrative and staff time, with very little return to the state.
And so
my comment is, obviously we'll fulfill our responsibility, but we sure lost sight of what we ought to be doing here if we're down the week talking about a few million dollars and naming rights and putting names on trucks. In fact, I think I'd like to reserve the Tunnel of Love for Downtown Tunnel.
Let me make a note of that.
I don't know which money you have for that one.
That's the point. And I just throw that out. I just don't know where we're headed with this.
Although, obviously,
there's value.
Yes, sir.
And there's intrinsic value, and then there's real value. I mean, I sat on a board of supervisors, and I looked at Mr. Garzinski over there, who can attest to this. We had developers come in and name things after their major clients, and we have SAIC Drive, we have Volvo Parkway. We can go through and name all the different roads that have some, obviously, commercial value.
Right.
And the question is, do we monetize any of that commercial value? Because obviously somebody else gets that. But I understand what you're saying.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Second, what Mr. Lane has said, we've got a $4 billion budget. We're looking at 4 to 5 years down the road where we're going to have absolutely no money whatsoever for new maintenance of highways. And here we are, we're hiring staff, we're hiring an outside company during this time on something that may generate up to $2 million a year. $10 million to cheapen our entire road system
in the state of Virginia where they traditionally have a bridge named after. I know we have one that we've named since I've been here of a EMT worker who died in the line of duty when there was a flood. We have them named after troopers who have been killed in the line of duty. And you look at these people who have dedicated their lives to service in the Commonwealth, and we are going to sell for $2 million naming rights to various things, put their stuff on signs. But it's not advertising. They're sponsoring, but it's not advertising. I think this is not the way to go. We have serious, serious problems with our finances for the roads in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and selling naming rights for $2 million a year is not a serious effort to meet those problems that we have. And I don't like this. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Connie, what's the difference between this and Adopt a Highway?
Well, the Adopt a Highway program doesn't require you to pay a fee. You're providing a service. You're cleaning up the road. So it's much more geared towards civic organizations typically who are out there, whether it's the high school environmental club or the Ruritans or, you know, an individual, a lot of individuals who go out and pick up trash, and we put a sign out there so that, you know, we can appreciate them for their contribution to keeping Virginia clean.
Philosophically, it's the same thing. But,
yes.
Right. So
yes.
We asked them to go out and do 4 cleanups.
Yes.
I mean, so by doing, so we're already doing this. It's just, again, it's whether somebody goes out and really does the
work
cleanup
4
times a year, does that maintenance for us, or we're now asking somebody instead to pay a fee.
Yeah. Yes. I just think that Mr. Main and Mr. Peek were very, very eloquent. I can't add a thing to what they said. I think they're absolutely on target. I think it's an embarrassment to have the head of our maintenance, and she's got a lot of problems to deal with, to have to fiddle around with this kind of stuff when she needs to be back in her office doing more important things. Is this thing discretionary? Can we just say we don't want this under the statute? No,
it's not.
So we can refuse to fund it, right?
You're not funding anything. I mean, no, you can't.
Yeah, we can say we don't want the staff. We forbid the staff to spend any money.
Mr. Rich, you don't have that sort of executive power.
It's law.
It's the law.
So we have to.
We're going to follow through on what the General Assembly passed. You don't have a choice in making decisions as whether you comply with state statute or not.
But it's a mandatory permit.
Yes, it is.
We must do this.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. I mean,
we better see our members of the General Assembly. Huh?
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
In the absence of Mr. Miller, I'll play the contrarian. While I understand what all of my colleagues are saying, you know, as a business person, if I could convince the bank to give me $1 billion, I guarantee, loan me $1 billion, I guarantee I'd run my business slightly different. The fact of the matter is we'd all probably like to do things differently. We only have certain tools, certain resources available to us. The bank sits on up Broad Street a little bit, and until they're willing to free more money up, I applaud you for looking at the innovative, creative ways to get to this, and albeit $10 million is a small number compared to $4.5 billion in annual budget, it's still a big number, and it's still it'll pay for a project or two out there.
And to go along, I mean, you know, so right now we drive around here. In fact, we'll walk outside right now and we'll watch the buses go by with advertising. We can go onto the metro system and see the advertising. We can see, you know, billboards on the side of the road that have value to it. Yesterday we did this announcement on, you know, what we're getting out of is our commuter parking lot. But what is they just looking at for Prince William County for a stadium? They're looking between $15 and $30 million for naming rights for a baseball stadium because it's next to 95. and you'll be able to see it, and it'll have a big name, and they have people who are willing to put that type of money down on. The thing is here, and we're going to figure it out, is the value of the naming rights and the sponsorship rights will be driven by how much the Federal Highway Administration will allow us to. But more importantly, and I'm going to keep on going at this and drilling at the staff about, is the real value is as we drive along and we see it, you had it there with your with the PDA picture, is that today everyone has a PDA. That sign doesn't have to be up on the roadway. It can be on the map, and it can be on the application that are brought, that the actual people are looking at. We haven't been able to quantify because, unfortunately, we got a 20th century view of this opportunity in a 21st century technology world. And we don't know how to put the numbers on those yet. And that's where we're going to go and look for the outside.
Well, each of the individual contracts for 511 and the state program have marketing companies that we are working with to try and help develop them.
Mr. Chairman, one quick follow-up. Ms. Sorrell, you didn't share with us your potential sponsors for the toll gantries. There are people lined up on there.
I'm sure there will be.
That's when they got the arms put down.
Would there be an amount of time for the naming right is? In other words, I'm thinking that we have the Coleman Bridge, and you know people know it as the Coleman Bridge. And then the naming right lasts for 2 years, and it's changed to the Johnson Bridge. And I mean, you know, and how that impacts. So I would encourage us to look at a time period that may be useful in terms of how the public perceives, you know, something in its name. I just throw that out.
Yes.
But by the way, what you do with these, if you have the names, because I got experience with this a little bit. We'd have, like we had with the Richard Fitzner Stadium, and then we would say sponsored by whatever. You still have the name. And you might have a memorial named a bridge or whatever.
You'd be sponsored by,
and that's all you did. And that's all there.
That makes
Chairman,
yes.
Just one. This is more of a customer thing. I just want to thank you and the maintenance people. We had serious storms up in our area. We had trees all over the road. And from across my district, from Albemarle to Fauquier, people were very complimentary of VDOT for getting these huge trees out of the roads. And really, thank you and your department for getting that done.
Thank you, Mr. Rich.
Mr. Ellis, did
yes,
you?
One last question. Now, I know you mentioned on the 511 it was going to be a Droid and iPhone app.
Yes.
My question is, are we going to have a BlackBerry app?
Actually, we're not.
We all have BlackBerry.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, I can only tell you that with my limited technical knowledge of BlackBerrys is there's so many different versions and operating systems that they have less than 20% of the market, which is actually interesting. But yes, I do have a BlackBerry, but yeah, unfortunately, there's no plan to do an app for BlackBerry. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you very much. Why don't we take a quick break? Grab lunches. We'll start at about 10 minutes. Is that okay? We can continue through.
Oh yeah. I'm
Blacked out. probably Stanley Morgan. Who knows, you know, but
I started my comment. I said, it's the law, I'm going to support it. So I'm not anti. I just want to. We spent $100 million for it.
I think we got an inside read. Yeah.
That's all
like
$100
million.
It would
be a little bit better with.
I want now.
You.
I'm going to draw
the pad. No. I'm going to draw.
I may have some money for you. I want you to come down and
look for this
gravel. The Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel.
Yeah. If I anything more on the gravel pit?
At our retreat. I'm going to call you secretary.
I mean,
I really would like you to do that. Talk about because.
We can tell about Ron is Hollis calling. I was calling him back. I was calling Johnson. Called me. Going to the
all right, thank you. I'm going to call you. I'm
going to
call you. I'm
going to call you.
Well, for you, it'll be. No, maybe there's a way we should invest that cash. There's lots of options to talk about. I thought I'd have the secretary. I'm at a retreat. I just want you to come down and talk about what's going on.
All right, I got you. There's a bridge meeting on the meeting.
All right, what is
the glamorous life of secretary.
I agree with you. I've enjoyed his concerns.
That was
hey, the Reverend Thompson.
That was only just a
captain. We had Thompson. We had the
Richmond here, you know what I mean. You don't get me.
There's your son. There's your son.
Thought with you.
And his name after me. That's right.
What'd you get?
Ham.
Cracker ham?
Yeah.
Cracker ham?
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Well, Doug, where can we put the Coulomb connector?
Yeah, that's good. We're a government of laws, not men.
How much money is
it? Ooh, very good. All right, you guys all want to start? Do you mind if we
start?
Let's start, please.
Let's keep moving.
Brindley, do you mind? We will start again.
No problem.
Go into the easy pass. Another.
Good afternoon. Chairman, CTV members. The Easy Pass team is comprised of financial planning and communications, and this afternoon I'm here to talk about the marketing side of Easy Pass. This presentation is basically an update from the one that I gave you guys in May in Bristol. So this is just an update for you. Our key goals, of course, is to Easy Pass Virginia is expanding to support the opening of new toll facilities beginning this summer, provide awareness, convenience, and availability, and create synergies through partnerships. The new toll facilities, Jordan Bridge, they had a little accident about 3 weeks ago, and they are delaying their opening. It's going to be now late August or early September for the Jordan Bridge. 495 Express Lane is on track and will happen in December. Elizabeth River Crossing tolls will begin January 2014. Now the new news that I have is Easy Pass at DMV. Service now available at 2 DMV locations. On June 25th we started in Chesapeake, and on July 16th, Monday, we started at Tyson's Corner. We're going to bring on additional DMV locations when the toll facility starts, when downtown Midtown begins in 2014. There's a separate walk-up window for the EasyPass service, and this is a full account service. You can do everything there. You can return the transponder, get a new transponder, and when you walk out, your transponder is ready to use.
Chairman, just a quick question. Is this correct, then, that in Northern Virginia, you have to just go to Tyson's to get this? That's it?
No, I'm getting to that answer. Give me a moment. I am very pleased to say that AAA Mid-Atlantic is our first retailer. They have 13 locations in the Northern Virginia area, and they will have additional locations. These are the list of locations in Northern Virginia, so they're quite a number, sir. Mm-hmm. And I have breaking news. This morning, Wegmans signed their retail contract, and they will have 6 locations in Northern Virginia. There's another retailer whose legal department has already signed off on the contract, and we're just waiting for the CEO to sign that contract. So we are moving. At the last meeting, I did have plots where I showed you the layout of what would be in the stores. I showed you the cart. Today, I do not have props, I'm sorry, but I will go over how EasyPass will work, EasyPass on the go. You walk into a Mid-Atlantic store, and if you're familiar with Lotto, you know when they sell lottery, there is a sign in there. You go in, you pick up a card, you take the card to the register, and you pick up a card if you want the regular transponder. There's a purple. Green is for the regular transponder, purple is for the flex. You take it up to the window, and you get your transponder. Put it inside your windshield, and when you get your EasyPass on the go, $15 is immediately available, but then you have to go online or call to get the other $20. As I was saying, if you're familiar with lottery, you know they're selling a lottery tickets in the store. They have a little sign on the window. This is what you'll see for retailers. There will be a display where you can pick up your green card for your regular transponder, your purple card for your flex. This is how the cards will look. This is the on-the-go EasyPass. You get the transponder, and you get instructions on how to mount it and how to use it. These are the directions to go with the EasyPass. EasyPass Flex, which is the new transponder, is the first of its kind, and this will allow free use on 495 express lanes. But in order to have free, you have to be HOV. You have to have 3 or more in your car. And this transponder will have a little switch that you flip on for HOV and you switch off for regular. EasyPass Flex Launch Media Event. We're going to have one with Transurban on July 25th. And our deputy commissioner will be there along with Transurban officials to kick off the Flex transponder. We enhanced our webpage. When you go to the webpage now, has a list of FAQs for you. It also tells you what other states will accept our EasyPass, tells you what other facilities here in Virginia that will accept your EasyPass. If you have a toll violation, it shows you what you need to do with your toll violation. So we have enhanced it, and it's a lot more user friendly. Any questions?
Chairman, I want to commend staff for getting 2 top flight retailers. I mean, Wegmans in Northern Virginia is like gold, and AAA is, that's really great.
Yeah, we're already doing some joint activities with Transurban. We did one at the Hilton. It was for some employees, and it was a great response. We have two more scheduled. We're working with the Jordan Bridge. We had outreach at the shipyard, the Norfolk Naval Shipyard. We did two employee events there. We also went out to a 4th of July holiday parade in South Norfolk. So we are working with the facilities to try to get transponders out. Any other questions? Mr. Secretary?
No. I'm fine for now.
Thank you.
Mr. Lawson, please, he'd have to make this presentation.
Oh, that's right.
You should have made that. See, that was the good news. You got grilled before.
I'll leave it at this. Thank you very much for being here. Please go out and get more of the marketing firms that you promised me. More retail locations. And Ms. Farmer, thank you for all your work.
What do we got?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. And we've got some rail access projects starting off with some good industrial development and some growth in existing industries here in Virginia. We have two for the board today to be briefed and also take action on, since we have a pause in the board schedule and not an August meeting. So we need to move forward while the construction schedule is open. Railroad track typically likes to be laid during hot or medium ambient temperature time. So that's why we're coming forward today with both a briefing and a request for action on the same day. Greenwood RRST is located in Branchville, Virginia. It's down in Southampton County. If you're not familiar with the location, you go to Boykins, turn right until you hit the next community, and that's the best way I can describe it. This is a growing industrial development for rail location. We did a project with Severn Peanut Company for their phosphate and nitrogen fertilizer unloading facility, as well as Greenwood has been unloading propane natural gas there for several years now under our program project that we came through in back in 2009. Due to the Marcellus Shale growth and development, as you all know, bottled gas is now, and natural gas is becoming more and more of a more cost-competitive and efficient commodity. As that has grown, Greenwood has gone forward with an expansion project to bring 500 additional carloads of propane and also natural gas from the shale fracking operation. They plan on spending about $950,000 for capital investment in the facility. As you know, propane and compressed natural gas are two different products, so they keep them separate as part of the development, as well as about $491,475 worth of rail improvements are also going to be conducted on the site. They currently employ two people. Unloading railroad cars is something that typically we look for the direct employment, but this will double the employment in this area. And also there will be some spillover ancillary jobs that we don't count towards this grant, which are the truck drivers to deliver the natural gas and propane. This application scored 60 of 100 points, which is very good. And we're going to recommend this project to the CTB later at the action meeting as well. As I said, we're their recipient in 2009. We've got the natural gas coming in. Rail is the preferred method for bottled gas. Obviously, a tank car of gas is certainly about four plus truckloads of highway commodity. So this is a great way to get it into the location, especially in this very remote area. So as we move forward, $142,000 is what we feel is eligible for this project. Remember, under the board's adopted policies and procedures for this rail industrial development program, only 15% of total capital outlay can be applied to a rail grant. So this caps them out at that amount as well. So therefore, they will not be required under the policies and procedures of the program to provide a match, but due to the discounting of the project under the policies and procedures, they'll be putting in over $300,000 of their own funds to develop, co-develop the rail project with us as we move forward. So this is the first project of two projects I'll be talking about today. Action number 8 on your briefing agenda today. Are there any questions, Mr. Chairman, members of the board? Okay. I'll very quickly pull up the next item. Item 9 is kind of an interesting project that we have. House Feed and Fertilizer Incorporated is House Trucking, also known in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, just north of Stanton, a place called Weir's Cave. And the interesting part of this is the House family has worked with the Buckingham Branch Railroad to develop a transload facility site in Doswell, Virginia, not very far from your operations up at Carmel Church. What's interesting about this is that about 11.5-12 miles from here is where I believe it's Nestle Farina has a large deposit of bentonite that they are mining. It's used to manufacture kitty litter, of all things. But they have to have a way to get it out in bulk commodities. So it's not very cost effective right now on a return of investment to build a rail line out 11 miles into that part of the I believe it's King William County. But the point is that we were able to set up a transload facility on the Buckingham Branch Railroad at the Doswell Yard with House Feed and Fertilizer making this development a reality. The application of about $127,500 towards construction of about 1,200 linear feet of track will extend the track off the Buckingham Branch into a piece of property that will be leased by the railroad to House Feed and Fertilizer to develop this transload facility. 600 carloads of bentonite clay will run through this facility a year, and of a $303,750 rail project investment, again, it gets into the discounting of the policies and procedures, very similar to how Greenwood was, $127,500 is eligible for the project. Currently, House Feed and Fertilizer employs 40 people. They'll dedicate 2.5 additional jobs down at the Doswell site for the transload facility. Again, this project does support a large investment that's been made for the kitty litter mining, quarrying, and also kiln drying operating facility. So just in retrospect to that as well, House Feed and Fertilizer was a recipient of funds from us, a program that this board has allocated up in the Weir's Cave area. They continue to grow. Matter of fact, VDOT is a good recipient of this as well because they unload the road salt that's used up in the Shenandoah Valley as well. House Feed and Fertilizer does and stores it under a canopy on site up at their other location. So this is a great project for us, helps out with the bentonite clay operation as well. We know that that has been a challenge as to how to get the clay out into the hinterlands and regions of the United States, so this will be a way that it can go out in bulk commodities. Just kind of in reference, 4 truckloads per rail car, so once it gets to Doswell, those trucks come off the road. So, Mr. Chairman, turn the floor back over to you on the second project for $127,500 in rail industrialized funds to House Feed and Fertilizer for this project.
Well, Mr. Chairman, could you educate the board on the difference between kitty litter and cat litter?
No, it's about the same.
Okay.
Great. I think there is a, now that you ask, you've unbottled the gas now. I have to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Call.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. At your leisure, you can cut me off. there is a clumping agent that they do bring in for certain types of kitty litter that you will find that some clumps and some does not. So that's another agent that's mined out in the Midwest that will also come to the plant location.
I retract my question.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you for asking to learn not to ask again, right? Thank you, Mr. Cole.
Any other questions?
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, public transit funding study. Mark, is it H?
Mark H.
Of transfer? Or is it going to be you, Mr. Pitt?
I'm going to try to pull it up.
Oh. Here goes the page. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm here on behalf of DRPT to give a little bit of an update and a report on where we are in regards to responding to the General Assembly related to SJ 297. And there's a number of slides that are in your package related to this, so I'm not going to go through slide by slide, but maybe more touch on the highlights. Let me maybe start by saying that the department is very, very both pleased and proud of the work that transit service providers are doing throughout the Commonwealth. What 297 really does in working in concert with the new federal authorization bill, MAP 21, which we just spent some time on this morning, is to create a framework for higher performance. So often what we see is folks simply getting money because it's the right day of the month, and there's not a relationship to quality or higher performance. And so what SJ 297 does is to lay that foundation where just like we all might with our private investment dollars make a decision as to where to put our money based upon past performance, taxpayers as well can look to see what past performance of a particular transit service provider was and recognize that they want to put their money where people have produced results. So let me maybe touch on four key points, and I'll go into each one in a little bit of greater detail. The first is the approach that the department has taken to SJ 297. The second is to touch exactly on where we are today. Thirdly, to indicate where we are with a preliminary report, and you will hear me use the words preliminary multiple times. And then finally, to give you a sense as to what we believe the path forward is related to this. So I'm going to start with the approach that we've taken. 297 is to introduce a word that is used too seldom in public sector management, and that is the concept of performance. Working with public agencies to see if we can't indeed provide a public sector service, but to do it with a private sector mindset. Today, when the Commonwealth distributes funding to transit service providers, increased funding is tied to increased spending. Those are the two pieces which correlate. If a service provider spends more money, they get more money. There's no link to performance. There's no link to the department's goals. There's no link to the governor's program. The second significant piece is the problem that we've discovered in the current approach is that it very much works off of old data. And so we're looking to see if we can't make changes to drive real-time information into that process. The approach that we've followed has been to be as inclusive as we can. We very much wanted this to be a collaborative process. We've had a number of stakeholder meetings that we've worked with. In fact, we're going to be holding our fourth stakeholder meeting in 2 weeks. The only reason that we're in front of you today is because there's not an August meeting. And so we wanted to be able to share with the board today where we are with a preliminary report. I guess I'll call it a draft preliminary report, because until we've had the opportunity to spend a little more time with the stakeholder group and feel comfortable in where we're going, we're not ready to call it a final report. We've looked at best practices nationally in regards to the distribution of aid, and we have found several. Predominantly, folks use a formula process, as we do today. They simply get money for showing up. But we're beginning to see more and more states like Kansas and New York and Michigan and many others beginning to transition to a performance-based approach, that results actually matter in connecting how we distribute dollars. So that's the approach that we've utilized, very much wanting to work and collaborate with current service providers. As I was touching on today, agencies simply get more money based upon how much more money they spend. Secondly, it's a very complicated formula. We've discovered in discussions with the department staff themselves, the process which the department goes through to distribute dollars is very, very complicated. There's a formula tied to eligible funds and ineligible funds and all of the auditing process that goes with that. And the entire discussion related to transit aid is about how to get more money rather than how to get better. And so the discussion that we're looking to have is how to work to motivate and to inspire transit service providers to learn from one another and drive performance and indeed connect results to taxpayer dollars. So we're at the point that we have a draft report, and as I say, draft report is indeed at that level. It's preliminary in nature. It's very rough. And one of the threshold questions the department has had to deal with is whether to follow the formula approach, as so many states do, or transition to the performance-based approach. And in grappling with that question, we decided that it was in the Commonwealth's and the department's interest to say yes. to blend a hybrid of those two approaches. And we did this in listening very closely to the transit service providers, whereby 50% of funding will be distributed on a formula basis, and there's two measurements that would go into that formula, one being ridership, the other being operating expenses. And on the performance side of the equation, there would be four metrics that we would look at: customers per hour and customers per mile, productivity measurements in regards to capacity, and then two measurements related to how efficiently the service provider uses their dollars, and that's cost per revenue hour and cost per revenue mile. The next part, taking this deeper, that we're looking to develop in this draft report where we're working with the transit service providers, is to create a level playing field. It certainly is not appropriate to have WMATA have their performance benchmarks compared to GRTC, for example. And so we are building a model where we will have peer groups that will be established, and the sorts of factors that will go into those peer groups include things like population, population density, the ridership, operating costs, the size of the agency, the number of peak vehicles that they operate, and then obviously a separation based upon whether it's a steel-wheeled operation or a rubber-wheeled operation. Similarly, on the capital side, we're looking to see if we can't establish much greater flexibility on the Mass Transit Trust Fund, and looking, quite honestly, to get that to more mirror the flexibility that the department has related to the Mass Transit Capital Fund, whereby they can have flexibility to use some of the dollars that are in the Mass Transit Trust Fund to support operations, and indeed to be able to use for all eligible costs and look at them individually as opposed to the limitations that they face today. There's four key pieces that were in the legislation themselves. The first is performance. And the way that we're looking to address that is a recommendation to revise the code of Virginia to allow that hybrid approach that I was describing, one related to formula and one related to performance. The second priority in the legislation was prioritization. And we're looking to establish a process where the department will come back to the CTB annually in order to put a program together related to capital expenditures and try to maximize state of good repair dollars. The third element in the legislation related to stability, and we're looking to suggest that there will be a 3-year transition period to this new formula, which I described, to allow agencies to be able to make the modifications that they need to and transition their thinking to be one of performance rather than simply related to formula. And the final point in the legislation was allocation, and that ties to the point that I've been making, allowing capital funds to support operations. The other key element under allocation is requiring that a local service provider would indeed have a match to DRPT dollars in making a capital investment. As I've indicated, we're at a draft stage. The only reason we're in front of you this month before we have our final stakeholder meeting for feedback that they've provided is simply a function of schedule. We'll be sitting down with them 2 weeks from now. Look forward to their feedback. We'll make a third set of modifications based on the feedback that the service providers have provided to us. And I think the fourth point that I would make is the path forward for this program. We've had extensive meetings with the stakeholders. We'll do that again in 2 weeks. We will finalize the SJ 297 report in August. We will provide draft legislation to go to the General Assembly in August. And in September, we will finalize and submit the report with the draft code modifications to the General Assembly. The exciting part of this is for the first time it begins to introduce the concept of quality and performance into the distribution of dollars, and is really a sea change in thinking we believe that this program will build a model that can be replicated not simply amongst other programs in Virginia, but indeed for transit systems as states provide aid in their communities nationwide. It's very clear to see from Map 21 that a number of public organizations are looking to introduce the concept of performance. We heard the Assistant Secretary mention performance metrics about 10 times in his comments. Taking action on this puts the Commonwealth at the forefront of that conversation. So with that, Mr. Secretary, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Excellent. Any questions? So these recommendations are going to be very warmly supported by the transit community?
We have worked with great intent to have the process be as collaborative as it could possibly be, recognizing that change is always a challenge for folks. I think we're at probably month 18 in this transition at this point. So we've had a lot of comments back from the transit service providers. We're going to sit down another step with them. And then once we have finalized the report to go to the General Assembly, we've certainly made the commitment we're going to sit down and work very closely and offer training and further discussions with the individual service providers.
You know, after hearing that answer, I think, do you have any extra time we might be able to use you on explaining easy pass fees?
Mr. Colmack. Yes, sir, thank you very much for the brief. Back on your slide 6 where you basically have documented some of the problems in the program now. So some of these are fairly simple. For example, using more recent expenditure data makes sense. Speeding that up, being more responsive in real time. Some of these are pretty broad. For example, no direct link to policy goals. That's a continuous problem, not just in transit, but in most government-related activities, because policy goals sometimes suggest expenditures, and expenditures don't necessarily follow. So I wonder if the progress you're attempting to make as well is complicated a little bit by how detailed you're going to make these performance measures. I mean, is it one of the goals to make more certain, to make it simpler, to make it more understandable, to make it understood as fair? And doesn't complexity work against, you know, all the factors work against that sort of simpler analysis?
I think a couple things. You asked about 4 different questions there, so let me try to pick out a couple of them that would maybe work. The first is, I think when the board was able to hear the business plan earlier this morning for DRPT, I think taking that as they intend to and manifesting that in very clear strategies as we get this new funding program up and running, this hybrid approach that I described, being able to more directly connect the allocation of dollars to those key strategies that the department will have will be critical, and having the business plan in place will allow for that. I think to your point of simplicity, absolutely. You know, as you're making a transition, 100% of dollars have been allocated based upon a formula. If you spend more, you get more. And so making this transition where performance actually matters, the quality of service matters, the capacity with which you provide service matters, you want to get that, I think, as simple as you can to get started. This is a real sea change in folks' thinking. And we can certainly come back and perhaps look to modify the formula or modify the performance measurements as we go forward.
Mr. Chairman, I would say this too. I would hope my colleagues, as well as the director of DRPT and others involved directly, would view this as in a positive sense. In other words, our whole purpose is to prompt better, more efficient service. It's really not to penalize or shut down systems that are underperforming, is to provide that benchmark of where you're moving. Because I do think there's a developmental aspect to transit in many parts of the Commonwealth, that the state should be a forward-looking investor and helping those things happen, as opposed to simply, let's see if you can do it, and if you can do it, you know, we'll reward your performance. If you can't, well, that's too bad for you. So I hope we view it as a positive developmental set of steps for transit in general.
Director Drake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Coleman, because that's exactly where we're coming from with this study. I mean, exactly the intent when the study was introduced a couple of years ago to really look at the big issues. We understand that we have one pie for transit, and as we get these larger projects like the Tide and Dulles 2 and Dulles 1 coming on board, that what we're doing in effect is cutting that pie into smaller pieces. But we also don't think that we can go to the General Assembly and say, this is what we think we need, until we can show what we think we need and what the results of the money today. And so one of the goals of this study, not only to be more effective in a government role and in this service that's provided, but how do we lay out what we really need and how do we make that argument to the General Assembly? And how do we, what I've seen is we need to change the message, because so many people look at transit as simply moving people that don't have much money as opposed to a transportation option that can be the solution for congestion. So I think we're trying to grow up and say this is what we're really all about.
To your point, if I could just add to it, of it being a positive experience, that the reason folks like baseball is because it's divided into divisions and someone rises to the top, and that inspires others in that division to go to that same level of performance. There's a reason we're recommending establishing peer groups here, so that same sort of spirit. The Oakland A's started the concept of Moneyball, and we've many of us have seen the movie or read the book. That inspired other teams across the league to follow that same approach, and we're hopeful that will replicate in the transit community here in Virginia.
So there could be a new WHIP number for transit.
Exactly right.
Okay.
Following this conversation, I think really we need to look at this as a positive point and a very clear sense of allowing localities to use this as an example of how they may adjust things. But for the reason, what I'm getting at is some of the transportation routes, you can probably go out there now and see where there would be low ridership, high cost to operate that particular route. But politically, it would be unwise or very difficult for them to cut that route or move that bus to another line. With this approach in, I believe, we will be allowing localities, if they look at it in the positive light, to make those changes and justify them based on the point of getting reimbursed on and getting some movement in that line, and I think it's more palatable to localities for them to view it that way and be able to make those changes without the politics, reduce the politics to some degree.
And Mr. Chairman?
Just
to add on to that is, or if they decide to keep the route, that they understand why and what the decision is that they've made and why that they've made it, because my observation in this role is you really have a triple function: to provide a transportation function, but you have a social services function, and you have an economic development function that you get to pay for it all. Our new transit systems that we've brought up, that local governments have come to us, is because employers have said, we want to locate in your city, but you have no better transportation system, and we don't know how employees will get to work. So if they could make the argument back, maybe this route, when you look at the cost of an individual route, doesn't support itself, but this employer does make it worthwhile that we did it. So I think it gives us answers to make good decisions, like you said, or to explain why they made a decision someone else might have thought was bad.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next presentation was about the transistor tire got caught up. And he, what he's going to do is he's going to mail out the presentation with some notes to everyone. So it's just really an update on the B-Trans. So we'll go right to Route 501 bridge replacement.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the board. My name is Angel Deem. I'm with the Environmental Division at VDOT, and I'm here to present the Route 501 bridge replacement location study and environmental assessment that has been underway. So the purpose of the presentation is to present the results of the location study to date for this project. The Route 501 bridge crosses the James River and the CSX Railway in Amherst and Bedford County. So I'm going to present the results of the EA and also a summary of the public involvement that was done. general location of where we are in the state is here. Zoomed into the study area, this shows the existing bridge over the James River. The study area extends about a mile downstream from that. Some background on the project. The existing bridge was constructed in 1921 with a full deck replacement done in 1967. The bridge has been identified as a priority for replacement due to its structural and roadway geometric deficiencies. The bridge has periodically been subjected to weight restrictions, most recently in 2009. It is fully funded in the department's six-year program with dedicated bridge funds. The current scoping estimate is $19 million for this replacement. The scope of the project is to replace the bridge. We've identified a preferred location 0.7 miles south of the existing crossing. To redesign the intersection of Route 501 and 130 to improve traffic operations. Currently there are deficiencies there, an inability for trucks to make right and left turns there on 501, 130. So this project will also include provisions for that. And it will also include demolition and removal of the existing bridge. So you have this in your packet as well, but on the screen is a depiction of the study area. It shows the existing bridge as well as the location that we've identified as the preferred new crossing for the bridge. And this is a summary of impact table from the environmental assessment. So you can see the few impacts associated with this location that we've identified. The one residential displacement, I just point out that residence is abandoned, and the property acreage shown there from two other residences in proximity to the new crossing location. Public comment, the EA was approved for public availability on April 17th. We ran a comment period from May 20th to June 20th and held a public hearing on June the 4th. We had four persons in attendance, and to date we haven't received any comments on the environmental assessment. So finally, our path forward, our next steps will be to request at your next meeting approval for the location for the new crossing, the September meeting, and then following that, we would complete the environmental assessment addressing any comments received and request Federal Highways approval, and we would expect all that to culminate in October. This project is set for advertisement in June of 2014. Can I answer any questions?
Does it have open parapets?
I'm sorry?
Will it have open parapets?
I wouldn't want to speculate, but I could let you know.
Okay, that's good enough. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about MDTC, Mr. Coulomb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and colleagues. First of all, let me say this presentation is brought to you by GEICO. So easy that even a CTV member can do it.
Sponsored.
Sorry. We got to get that lingo down.
Just said FDIC.
First of all, let me say, since the board asks that a board committee of two, Mr. Garzinski and myself, get together with DRP, representatives and representatives of the local jurisdictions in Northern Virginia, including those who are associated directly with the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, that we've had many conversations, meetings, email exchanges, and so forth among the various parties. And on the one hand, I would like to tell you that never have so many talked so much about so little, because it's a tedious set of details that we were actually working through. But I'd also like to say, as a result, that we have identified a lot of common ground, and we think we have identified a way forward. First of all, you'll have a resolution in front of you in our action agenda. The resolution itself is fairly general. It doesn't necessarily solve all the problems that we set out to tackle, but the general language is basically that DRPT funds will be dispensed actually directly to the local jurisdiction,
conditioned on the localities recording the allocated funding in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles and with the intended purpose of providing for the local jurisdiction's transit service. So this accomplishes a couple of things from the CTB point of view. Number one, it sets out the general guidelines on which we would like the parties here to proceed. Number two, it keeps us out of the details of what those process agreements are going to be so that they can be flexible enough to make them effective in their own circumstances. And three, it allows us then to proceed with the reimbursements, disbursements of funds, and so forth, because it authorizes the parties to reach agreements by letter and otherwise on the details of the process. Now, we set out really to further DRPT's objective of increasing clarity and transparency in the agreement, and with WMATA, the local jurisdictions, and the Transportation Commission. We also wanted enhanced reporting and accounting where necessary, because DRPT, rightfully so as it turned out, sensed that there were some inconsistencies in applying the Code of Virginia, the Appropriations Act, the auditor, state auditor's own guidelines, and so forth. And so all those things needed to be consistent. And then finally, we wanted to ensure that the process that evolved was simple and efficient, and also allowed and actually furthered the continued collaboration among the local jurisdictions in the transit and public transportation area that is a part of the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission. So CTB in this case will be providing guidance. We are the individual entities will be establishing the process so they can proceed, and we should be able to proceed as the agreements and letters of understanding are exchanged without further delaying any project payments or reimbursements, which is an important goal of everyone that's been involved. I will tell you this. The local governments do continue to have some specific objectives they would like to see. They want to continue to use the Transportation Commission as their agent, and that will be allowed. They want to continue to distribute funds as they're reimbursed through what they call their subsidy allocation model. And that is going to be possible. They want to make sure that as we change the process, that the state does continue to reimburse the Transportation Commission for the operating expenses that it incurs, and that also has been agreed to. And then finally, everyone wants to be, not just by the spirit of the law, the letter of the law, and we expect to have a briefing fairly soon for the local governments on the auditor of public accounts, who's got sort of ultimate responsibility to make sure that state funds are dispersed and accounted for properly. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we've made a lot of progress. I hope you can see that I hope you can see why the resolution is as broad as it is. It's trying to keep the CTB out of the operational details and out of a monthly review of this process. But it does set in motion the ability for the local jurisdictions, DRPT, WMATA, and NVTC to conclude the framework among themselves and with each other. And as they do that, the process will go forward without further CTB action. So I'd love to answer any questions somebody may have. Otherwise, that's both the long and the short of it. Mr. Rich?
I guess the only question I have is we're not going to delay any funding to Northern Virginia for transit, right? I mean, this is the economic engine of the Commonwealth atop the Golden Crescent. I mean, this is nothing to play around with.
I think, Mr. Rich, that was at the top of everybody's list. What we've learned is this, that actually most of these projects that are the jurisdictions execute that are in the six-year plan actually involve reimbursement from DRPT after the fact. So, in fact, the reimbursements can go forward based on the work being done, the projects being completed, and so forth. The one concern here was the localities do front money out of their existing funds or trust funds for something like their WMATA payments on a quarterly basis, and then they're reimbursed, and those are quite significant payments. So, for example, in June, they've just paid the July 1 payment. So DRPT will be reimbursing them there. So the question would be, we want to make sure that somehow that doesn't get out of sync and that the DRPT reimbursements aren't lagging so far behind that somehow the localities are out of there, that they don't have the money to make their next payment.
What are the major differences remaining? You mentioned some of the things that they've agreed on.
Well, for example, in the resolution we talk about generally accepted accounting principles, and I think there's a difference of interpretation in what that requires. The localities do understand the need to actually take possession of the funds in their own accounts. In the past, they've accounted for those with footnotes in their financial statements or otherwise. DRPT would like to see them make that reporting and accounting much more a part of the real reports as opposed to footnotes, so that the public is very clear that state money is actually going into the local systems and into WMATA. So it's things like that that are continuing.
Have we gotten any feedback? I know the delegate and Delegate May stood on this MVTC. What's their view on this?
Well, I can't say if there's a common NVTC view, but I do think that everybody's main concern was that the localities would be able to continue to use NVTC as their agent. And DRPT is fine with that as long as the accounting path of where the money is, where it goes, how it's allocated, how it's assigned, and so forth is clear.
Thank you.
Mr. Lane, for the one. I read your resolution. This may be a question for Mr. Willett, if he's an accountant, but there is a distinction between the generally accepted accounting principle and generally accepted governmental accounting principle. So I just want to make sure in your resolution you use one fiduciary, oriented, the other for profit oriented. So I just wanted to raise the question that we were to say generally accepted or generally accepted governmental accounting. Because there is, if that's open for debate, there is a distinction.
It probably would be better stated as general accepted governmental accounting principles,
fiduciary,
but it probably wouldn't have any material impact on the resolution.
All right.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Well, how do you think Ms. Cool and I did? Should we invite them back? Okay. Well, that finishes off the workshop. We will now go to the action.